You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Maria Santelli. She is the executive director of the Center on Conscience and War, two things that you might not imagine go together, a 75-year-old organization founded to provide technical and community support to conscientious objectors to war. Based in Washington, D.C., Santelli has been working for peace and justice since 1996. You may want to check out the website of the Center on Conscience and War. It is found at centeronconscience.org, and you can find out your rights as a member of the military in any capacity, or a possible prospective member of the military, or anyone else. Call 1-800-379-2679 or check out centeronconscience.org. Maria also has a couple of excellent articles just published on truthout.org that we may be talking about. Maria, we are sort of in wartime, sort of in peacetime. There's no draft. What is the relevance of conscientious objection right now?
Well, I would say we are definitely in wartime, especially looking at what just happened this weekend. I can't let this discussion go by without mentioning the sickening events in Afghanistan on Saturday when the United States bombed the hospital, the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz. Not only bombed it, but bombed it for a sustained 30 minutes when there were no reported firefights in the vicinity and when the United States long had the exact coordinates and the hospital was well marked. And this is just a disgusting event. I should be celebrating with my organization 75 years of supporting those who follow the counsel of their conscience and resist war. But I can't celebrate because I'm made sick by what war is. And this indiscriminate violence is war. It defines war. It characterizes war, every war. And so as I think about the suffering of those who are already wounded or sick and were in a hospital, because of the work that I do, I also think of those members of the U.S. military who were part of that bombing. And many of them are going to shake it off for at least the time being. But many of them will feel eventually, and many of them will feel immediately, the consequences of those actions. They will understand this was not a mistake. This is just war. This is what war is. And for them, for many of them, this moment will crystallize their conscience, and they will urgently need a way out. They'll need a way to follow their conscience and separate themselves from the United States military and from their participation in war. And at that time, the Center on Conscience and War will be there for them, as we have been for conscientious objectors for 75 years. And we will help them follow the legal pathway that is available to them to be able to walk away from the United States military and become part of the larger movement for peace and justice.
And what is that legal pathway? What can they do to get out? What action should someone take who has figured out once they're in the military that they're engaged in something evil?
Well, so as you mentioned, without a draft, what does this look like? So, of course, in the draft days, when our organization, the Center on Conscience and War, was founded in 1940, there was a draft. So our work was to keep men of conscience, it was only men, out of the military and provide them with alternative service. It wasn't that they didn't want to serve, they just didn't want to kill people. So we helped to provide them with alternative service, helped them craft their statements of conscience to not be drafted, to not be compelled to kill other people. So in 1962, there was still an active draft going on, but the Pentagon actually realized that there are going to be people who were either already drafted or perhaps maybe joined voluntarily, but have a crisis of conscience and realize once they get in there that they cannot do this. They cannot in good conscience actively take part or even passively take part in war and war making. And so since that time, since 1962, there has been a process by which members of the military can apply for discharge. There is DOD, they call it DOD, Department of Defense Personnel Policy. But there are, each branch has its own regulations on how to apply for discharge as a conscientious objector. So when people realize that they can no longer take part in war making, they can obviously give us a call and we'll provide them with all of the support that they need, or they can, you know, download these regulations themselves and make their application. They have three legal burdens to meet. They have to prove that they are opposed to their participation in war in any form. They have to prove that these beliefs developed after they joined, after they enlisted, after they commissioned, whatever their particular case may be. So people say, well, you know, didn't they know what they were getting into? Well, you know, not to say that these people didn't have some responsibility, but of course they didn't really realize what they were getting into. We're sold such a heap of goods, you know, about what military service is, what war is, that a lot of times young people, they haven't thought about it at all, or they've been grossly misled when they join the military. So that's part of their burden. They have to prove that they are someone different, that when they joined the military, maybe they thought it was a necessary evil. Maybe they thought they were going to be getting the bad guys. They didn't think they were going to be bombing hospitals in Kunduz, Afghanistan. And then the third legal burden that they have is that they have to show that their conscience, these beliefs, are a controlling force in their life. In other words, they cannot live with themselves if they continue on this path of war. And so we help them craft applications that will enable them to follow their conscience.
Maria, you mentioned that some people might look at an incident like bombing a hospital and burning the patients to death and say, well, that was just one accident in an otherwise admirable mission that's a necessary evil and so forth. It seems to me a lot of people are going to take one step further and say, oh, well, this particular war is mistaken and misguided, and other wars are good and justifiable. And that apparently doesn't count, doesn't register with Department of so-called defense policy. They have to go a third step and get to the understanding that, in fact, the entire institution of war is evil. And that's extremely hard to get even peace activists to that point. How many people sort of get stuck? They haven't quite gone far enough in their understanding to actually qualify to conscientiously object.
Well, that's the real power of this process. I mean, how many of us, especially, you know, people listening to this program, people who are Pacifica listeners specifically, really know their own hearts, they think. We think we know our own hearts. We think we know our own conscience. But how many of us have actually gone through that exercise of writing down what it is that you believe, your values, your moral framework, what tells you what is right and what is wrong? Not only do you write that down, you trace its evolution, how you came to develop those beliefs, and then you prove through example how you live those beliefs in your life. That's what these members of the military have to do. How many of us have ever performed that exercise? It's a real worthwhile one. I would recommend people, you know, give it a try. It's very difficult, but it really, it helps you understand your own motivations, your own soul, your own heart. And oftentimes in that process, you come to that place when you do that kind of analysis of your values and how they relate to war, how those values tell you that this war might be wrong, because that's where people are coming from. Your objection by law can't be political, but of course everybody is coming from a particular political space in time. That's your frame of reference. Your frame of reference is you were in Iraq, or your frame of reference is you were in Afghanistan, or you played some kind of support role for this war making in 2015 in this modern time. But that is a place that people will springboard from to realize, no, all war is wrong. This isn't an isolated incident. This isn't just something that happened today. This isn't just something that happened with this kind of technology. They get to that place where they realize when they really dig deep and pull back all those layers and reveal their core values, they realize that they cannot reconcile their conscience with any war.
I wish more people would get to that point, of course, as you do. But, you know, this week, not only did the United States blow up a hospital in Afghanistan, and all of my friends and peace activists who've been saying stop bombing Afghanistan for 14 years kept saying it, but also Russia started bombing Syria. And peace activists who have not only gone through writing down their beliefs, but have sat in police vans with me and gone to jail for their beliefs and resisted military funding and preparations for war, as well as particular wars, started cheering for Russian bombs in Syria, because somehow that will bring law and order and oppose the U.S. bombing in Syria. Now, shouldn't we be supporting conscientious objection among the Russians in the military as well? Isn't that what Tolstoy would have done? Or you know, somehow do people think they oppose all wars and they don't really? There comes along a different aspect and now it's okay.
Absolutely, we should be supporting conscientious objectors. How can we ask someone, if you're a peace activist and you've taken your body, you've either by active decision or by default taken your body out of participation in war. A lot of people have resisted taxes, I think you just alluded to, so that they take their dollars actively out of the act of war. But then you would allow someone else, someone else's body, someone else's dollars to do what you yourself have said no, you cannot do. That doesn't seem like it's a very fair decision to make or a very fair position to hold, because there are going to be consequences, not just for the people who are burned alive in their beds because they can't escape, for the people who lose limbs, but for the people who carry out the war. We have decades and decades and generations of people that we know of, that are our family members, that are our community members, who suffer the tragic consequences of war, even the good war. How many people have a grandpa who never talked about the war? He was in the good war, the World War II. That was the good war, but he never talked about it, or he had a drinking problem. Tens of thousands of people resisted World War II, the good war. There are volumes written about why that was not a good war. Quakers, who founded our organization, were among the groups that founded our organization, refused to fight, but that didn't mean that they weren't putting their bodies on the line in some other way. I have a dear friend whose name some people may recognize, Dory Bunting. She's a Quaker. She's in her 90s. In 1939, her Quaker parents sent her to do solidarity with the Jews in Germany. These people were not afraid of confrontation. They weren't afraid of nonviolent conflict to solve problems. They put their bodies on the line, but they knew that war was not going to solve anything. How is war going to continue to solve any of the problems in Afghanistan or in Syria or with ISIS? War created those problems. War is at the heart, and so it can never be the solution.
Is World War II, Maria Santelli of Center on Conscience and War, is World War II still predominantly the package of myths that lead to people resisting the idea that all war is wrong? I mean, it seems to me, you know, despite all the missteps from the ending of World War I forward that led unnecessarily to World War II and all of the evil of World War II that made war about killing civilians and the absolute irrelevance of the killing of the Jews and others in the camps, which had nothing to do with U.S. motivation in World War II, it seems to me that for the entire existence of your organization, for 75 years, people have been saying, well, this war is bad, but World War II was good, so I can't oppose all war. Is World War II really the problem in terms of education?
It still is. I was just at a hearing down at Dahlgren Naval Base in Virginia on September 24th. One of our Navy conscientious objectors and his investigating officer asked him, come on, really? What about World War II? What do you think we should have done there? Do you think we should have just allowed that slaughter of millions of people? And yes, it is absolutely still held up and even you know, tossed out into conscientious objectors' faces. Of course, now we add to that, well, what about 9/11? Shouldn't we can't, we couldn't have retaliated. We shouldn't have sought justice for 9/11. Also, we now hear about ISIS, of course. one of our Air Force officers that we worked with is a Christian. Now, again, the modern definition of conscientious objection, back in 1940 when we started, you could only be a religious objector. Your objection could only be based on your religion. Now we have folks who the law has opened up over the last 75 years through court challenges, and an atheist can be a conscientious objector, a Buddhist, obviously, an agnostic, any moral or ethical objection to war counts legally as a conscientious objector. But this particular Air Force officer was a Christian, and his conscience crystallized when the Christians were held by ISIS and under siege last summer, 2014, and were being exterminated in great numbers. And he searched his heart, and as a Christian, he thought, do I believe in using war to save other Christians? And when his own answer was no, I cannot support war, even to save a minority of Christians in this community, that is when he knew he had to seek a separation from the military. I think people, you know, I think our conscience tells us, if we take the time to search, our conscience will tell us that war is wrong, that war is only going to lead to more war. How can the United States, especially now with what just happened on Saturday, how can the United States build any more trust of the people of Afghanistan? How can the United States actually be the partner with the Afghan government to get rid of the Taliban, or to unify the people of Afghanistan? How can we do that when this is our tactic? When war only serves to divide?
Indeed, it brings more war, and it created that danger to those Christians. It didn't arise out of nowhere; it arose out of past wars. What if you're not in the military? What if you're not paying taxes? What if you're just turning 18 and you're supposed to register, at least if you're male, right? You're supposed to register for the draft. Should you do that?
Well, that's an individual matter of conscience, and we support people who make any choice. It's pretty devastating. I mean, people think, oh, a draft is never coming back. Well, probably not. A draft probably does not have the popular support in this country to actually become reality. But one of the roles of our organization, especially being based in Washington, D.C., is that we monitor what's going on with the Selective Service System, a $26 million organization, by the way, who has a dual mission, and the mission is supposed to be equal. Both sides of the mission are supposed to be equal. The first is to provide personnel to the DOD. Provide bodies to the war machine. That's half of the Selective Service System's mission. The other half is to provide for the conscientious objector community in time of war. That means that they provide alternative civilian service for conscientious objectors, and that's a victory that our organization won 75 years ago, because before that, in World War I, conscientious objectors were forced to do non-combat military service, so they still were part of the war machine. So today, a young man may still have reservations. Just putting his name on a piece of paper, just getting on that list to be provided to the DOD, to be personnel that the Selective Service provides to the DOD, that in and of itself can be a violation of conscience for the young man. Because outside of an active draft, the Selective Service does not register conscientious objectors. That's good and bad. It's unfortunate for people for whom, you know, it is a violation of their conscience to register. But it's okay, because it puts everybody on an even playing field. You know, maybe you didn't know what conscientious objection was, and so you didn't register as a conscientious objector. And then in the event of a draft, you're not at a disadvantage from someone who was raised with that vernacular and with that identity. So for a young man who it is a violation of their conscience to register, we have a loan program that young men can apply to help them finance college, because, of course, they are cut out of many of the benefits of citizenship simply for resisting putting their name on that line. But it's becoming less and less of an issue, because there are these laws that we have on the books in some 40 states plus the District of Columbia that actually associate your driver's license or your state ID with registering for the draft. And so a young man, in many cases, does not even have the opportunity to exercise his conscience. He doesn't have the opportunity, as the law says, to present himself. He is indeed presented by his Department of Motor Vehicles to the Selective Service Department. So the government has seen that when given a choice, young men will resist putting their name on this list. We saw in the 80s some young men being prosecuted, and they got to tell their story for not registering. They got to tell their story on the evening news. And to the government's surprise, the sympathy was with the resistors. And so that sort of, for lack of a better word, that sort of backfired in the government's face. So they no longer prosecute young men who choose not to register, but they cut them out of these benefits of citizenship, having never been prosecuted, let alone convicted, of any crime. You will be deprived of financial aid from the federal government and from some state governments and from some institutions of higher education, and you'll also be deprived in many states of the ability to obtain a driver's license or state-issued ID.
And you say, Maria, you say in some 40 states, they just automatically, when they've got your information at the DMV or whatever, they automatically register you for the draft. I think we're at 2 states now that automatically register you to vote. So you can see where the priorities are in the U.S. Yeah. government. Go fight, go kill people in the name of democracy is significantly more prioritized than actual democracy. I think in these recent wars, the U.S. military has seen a lot more people just desert than go through trying to conscientiously object. Which is better?
Well, it's tough. I mean, there's no question about it. It's a long process to legally seek discharge. It takes, at the very, very minimum, it will take 5 months. And that's if everybody does everything they should exactly at the time that they should do it. But that's rare, as you can imagine, because we're talking about the military. People think, oh, the military is very regimented. Everything's very efficient. That couldn't be further from the truth. There's a lot of sloppiness. There's a lot of laziness. And there's just a lot of dragging of feet in the military. In addition to that, conscientious objection is not a priority for the Department of Defense, as you can imagine. And so people end up spending a lot of time waiting. They are protected to some extent once they submit, once they declare themselves a conscientious objector. The DOD policy does say that they are to be given duties that conflict as little as possible with their stated beliefs. That means they're not going to be, you know, required to train with weapons or to fire weapons and things like that. But, of course, every job in the military supports the ability for the military to make war. That's what it's for. That's what it exists for. So it is hard. It's hard for people to endure several months of waiting while their claim is pending. But we see an incredible effect, a transformative effect, just declaring oneself a conscientious objector, just taking that proactive step and saying, no, I'm going to reclaim my conscience, I'm going to reclaim my life, and I'm not going to be part of this anymore. And that does often, most times, give them the strength to endure. And for a lot of people, that is important, that they're recognized as conscientious objectors, that it goes up to, in every branch, it goes to the level, to the highest levels of that chain of command in each branch, to the headquarters level. That's where the conscientious objection decision is made. So that's very important for a lot of people. For others, they have to remove themselves immediately. It is a matter of some quite literally sometimes life and death, and they have to take themselves out of the situation immediately. In that case, of course, we're there to stand by them as well. You know, I mean, it's that they're no less conscientious objectors just because they might have chosen to discharge themselves. Informally, we say. So I'm not going to pass judgment on anyone based on whatever they've needed to do personally to obey the highest law, which is their own conscience.
In one of your recent articles on truthout.org, you say that conscience is contagious. So when people conscientiously object, does that really start a trend? Do you see others conscientiously objecting? Does it make a difference for people to sort of openly take a stand and take a risk for resisting participation?
Absolutely. absolutely, it does. We are busier. I mean, we've really tried. We've been really going out of our way to make sure people know that this is an option, that you don't have, you know, too many times in the military, people feel like they have two options, obey your conscience or obey your orders. And a lot of times those two are not the same thing. And we want to make sure people know there is a third choice, and that choice is conscientious objection. And we've tried really hard in the last several years to make sure people know that. And we've seen the fruits of our labor. We've seen our caseload of conscientious objectors skyrocketing. We couldn't be more thrilled. We're really busy, but we couldn't be more thrilled. And the DOD has noticed this as well, and we're concerned about this because we see some shenanigans, for lack of a better word, going on that we're not happy with, and we've actually just initiated a congressional inquiry through conscientious objector Congressman John Lewis of Atlanta, through his office. He's initiated a congressional inquiry into all four branches to see what's going on. But I've spoken personally with a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps who said, we're really swamped with conscientious objectors right now. And he was, you know, mad about it. And I said, well, yeah, you don't have to tell me because I'm sending them to you. You know, so they see a rise as well, and they don't like it. So we see it's bad for morale. It's you know, a lot of times when people submit their applications, their commands will try to bargain with them, make deals with them, try to keep it quiet, you know, try to get them out some other way. In fact, they're instructed, if there are other ways to get this person out besides conscientious objection, do it. Because if the application proceeds, it compels this conversation around the unit and up the levels of the chain of command. It compels this conversation about the morality of war. And we hear over and over again people's commanders saying to them, I support you. I wish I could do it too, but I have, you know, this such and such excuse or that such and such excuse, or I'm this far from retirement. And they're actually quite sympathetic. It is the rare case where someone is ridiculed or ostracized. It is actually the rare case. Most people are supported, or at worst, they're tolerated as their application is progressing.
Well, it may be bad for morale, but I have to assume it's good for survival rates, looking at the suicide rate among veterans is so disproportionately higher than for non-veterans, those who go through a process of returning to a law-abiding, non-violent existence must have higher survival rates. We're just about out of time. Maria Santelli from the Center on Conscience and War, where can people go to get involved? What can they do to help you?
Well, visit centeronconscience.org, of course, and then, as you mentioned, the 800 number, which I don't know off the top of my head.
I've got it. call 800-379-2679.
We're on Facebook, Center on Conscience and War. We're on Twitter. Tell everyone that you know that conscientious objection is real. It is alive and well. It is possible. This myth persists that it's impossible. Nobody ever wins. We win all the time, and we help conscientious objectors win and get their discharge. And as you mentioned, it is a safer path. It is a healthier path. We see this trauma that members of the military are experiencing now, and we understand it to be moral injury, which is translated as a transgression against the conscience. And we find conscientious objection can be a powerful tool in both preventing and healing moral injury.
Maria Santelli, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David. Take care.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Pentagon has declared the bombing of a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, a mistake. But it will investigate itself to determine how U.S. bombs came to destroy the Doctors Without Borders facility, killing at least 22 people. Doctors Without Borders is calling for an independent investigation, and you would think journalists would too, since who knows better than they the administration's history of changing its story. The hospital attack is not the first of its kind, nor, if we are to understand the advice of generals that the incident means the U.S. should increase its military presence in the country, will it likely be the last. After 14 years, as of this week, of war on Afghanistan, what has the U.S. achieved? We'll hear from Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press. After a mass shooting like the one at an Oregon community college, in which a young man killed 9 people before being killed by police, we hear a lot in the media about gun regulation, appropriately enough. And we hear a lot about guns in relationship to mental illness, despite the fact that people with mental illness are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. What we hear least about is the thing over which journalists have the most control, the role of media themselves. The Oregon killer is believed to have made comments online that this is the only time I'll ever be in the news, and seems like the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight. Such remarks would track with what social scientists have long said about events like mass shootings, that they are, as it were, contagious, and that the contagion is spread through the media. A 1999 article in Fares Magazine Extra after the Columbine massacre cited Park Dietz and David Phillips, whose research finds that news reports, not video games, are the prime media mover in begetting copycats. UCLA's Dietz, arguably the nation's top criminal forensic psychiatrist, found that suicide, product tampering, and mass murder lent themselves to imitation, and that the degree of imitation was inspired by sustained and sensationalized media coverage. No one argues that mass shootings should be ignored by media or no facts about the killer released. It's a matter of how. Writing for The Atlantic after the Sandy Hook mass murder, sociologist Zeynep Tufekci suggested that, as we know that establishing a path of action, a complete narrative in which you can visualize your steps and their effects, is important in enabling follow-through, law enforcement should resist releasing, and media resist broadcasting, extensively detailed accounts about precisely which guns were used or how much RoboCop gear was employed. In particular, we aren't served by immediately hearing the killer's words or manifestos, which video games they played, or what their favorite bands were. Social scientists offer these guidelines hoping to inspire a conversation about the way public violence is covered. But it will be a hard one to have if media won't even acknowledge it. The New York Times, reporting that a final agreement had been reached on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a still-secret commercial agreement involving 12 nations in Asia and the Americas, subtly sneered at critics for opposing a document that they haven't been allowed to see. Quote, "Its full 30-chapter text will not be available for perhaps a month, but labor unions, environmentalists, and liberal activists are poised to argue that the agreement favors big business over workers and environmental protection," close quote. That's the paper's Jackie Calms. And, quote, "Long before an accord was reached, it was being condemned by both Mr. Trump, the Republican presidential frontrunner, and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who is challenging Hillary Rodham Clinton for the Democrats' nomination," close quote. Well, Calms presumably hasn't seen the agreement either, But that didn't stop her from reporting that the TPP could be a legacy-making achievement for President Obama and the capstone of his economic agenda to expand exports. She allows officials to sell the deal through selective leaks and broad claims like Obama's promise of, quote, opening new markets to American products while setting high standards for protecting workers and preserving our environment, close quote. Critics, meanwhile, have parochial agendas. Congressional Republicans who fear for local interests like sugar and rice or just oppose Mr. Obama at every turn. And then Hillary Clinton has been critical as she has campaigned among unions and other audiences on the left. You might hope reporters would see the secrecy around such an important deal as a problem in itself, rather than an opportunity to scold critics for jumping the gun. And, though the piece doesn't say it, draft chapters were exposed by WikiLeaks, including one on environmental rules that the Sierra Club's Michael Brune said, quote, falls flat on every single one of our issues, oceans, fish, wildlife, and forest protections, and in fact rolls back on the progress made in past free trade pacts, close quote. It's also not as though we've never heard of these so-called trade pacts that promise to boost American jobs and decidedly have not. So you can criticize critics, as the Times implicitly does here, for not waiting till all the secret details are revealed, just as you can say Charlie Brown ought to wait and see whether Lucy is going to yank away the football this time. And finally, at the CNN-sponsored Republican Party debate last month, one of the three panelists CNN selected to question the candidates was conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt, affiliated with the proudly right-wing Salem Radio Network. Hewitt's ideas run along lines of telling listeners it was hard to get tickets to an Ohio State-USC game because everyone knows, quote, it's probably the last football game we'll ever get to see before the United States gets blown up by the Islamists under Obama, close quote. He used the Republican debate to declare that Obama's knees buckled over Syria and that every Republican candidate was more qualified than Hillary Clinton. But at the upcoming Democratic Party debate, CNN has no plans to present any analog. There are no progressive advocates on their panel of questioners. The slate is four journalists CNN presents as neutral: correspondent Dana Bash and anchors Anderson Cooper, Don Lemon, and Juan Carlos Lopez of CNN in Español. That may represent some demographic diversity, but none of these is an unabashed progressive advocate, the way Hugh Hewitt is an unabashed conservative voice. Activists are calling on CNN to add a left-of-center voice. Listeners who are so inclined should join them. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. If you ever need evidence that the U.S. elite press are willing to distort journalism in order to carry water for the government, the New York Times gave it to you on a plate with this instantly infamous headline for an early report on the U.S. bombing of a hospital in Afghanistan. U.S. is blamed after airstrikes hit Afghan hospital. Avoiding passive voice constructions that obscure the chain of action is Journalism 101. Days later, the paper was still soft-peddling U.S. responsibility for the October 3rd attack that killed at least 22 people at a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz, including patients who burned to death in their beds, reciting credulously the administration's shifting explanations and justifications for what some say may constitute a war crime. The outrage of Kunduz is not about media, of course, any more than the outrage of the U.S. war on Afghanistan is only about Kunduz. This week marks 14 years of the U.S. dropping bombs on that country with no end in sight. Here to discuss the U.S. terror war and possible alternatives is Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her most recent book is Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. She's also author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, among other titles. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
Well, on the Kunduz hospital, the line, for a minute anyway, was that Afghan forces called in the airstrike. as though that provided some measure of absolution for the United States and the atrocity. Just to be clear, the U.S. bears responsibility for where U.S. bombs drop, does it not?
It absolutely does, and I think that we saw that yesterday in a quite unusual move by President Obama to officially apologize, something he had not done before that. But yesterday he apologized for the strike, called the head of Doctors Without Borders, and made clear that this was a U.S. decision. Also earlier, I believe it was on Tuesday, the commanding general in Afghanistan made clear that the decision had been made by U.S. forces and the decision had been taken up the chain of command. So that at least made clear that there was no longer going to be an effort to say this was simply somebody got the coordinates wrong or something, you know, try and keep it at a very low level. By saying the decision went up the chain of command and the U.S. apology, it means there is now no question about U.S. accountability. The real question will be whether there will be anyone held accountable for this decision.
Well, we now are hearing it described as a mistake. And as you note, Obama has expressed condolences for it. John McCain, for one, says that it's, quote, ludicrous and insulting that people would say that because of this terrible accident that somehow a war crime was committed. The Taliban do these things on purpose and with a plan. This was a terrible accident. It's called fog of war, close quote. Well, while the Pentagon may in fact regret it, how appropriate is it to call this an accident?
Well, I think that it's not appropriate at all, clearly. One of the things that's interesting about the facts as they come out is that while the U.S. continues to claim that the Afghan call for a close air enforcement, a close bombing raid on supposedly their soldiers who were taking fire, they claim that this was going on in the hospital or in the compound. It's been vague which one they're talking about. But in both cases, the people that were there at the time, those who survived of the Médecins Sans Frontières staff, have been very clear that there was no one from the Taliban in the hospital and that the compound had been sealed, that the only people in and around the compound and the hospital were medical staff, patients, and families, that there was no fighting going on. So this claim by whatever Afghan soldiers called in an airstrike simply had no basis in fact. Now, one can wonder, now, why would they then call in an airstrike on a civilian hospital? That just sounds crazy. Well, we now know that there's a reason for it, not a justifiable reason, but an explanation, which is that last July, 3 months ago, this same hospital was essentially invaded by armed soldiers of the Afghan military who came in firing their weapons into the air to frighten people, which of course they did, demanding to take with them three patients in the hospital who they claimed were Taliban fighters. Now, it's certainly possible that three men were Taliban fighters who had been wounded. The ability of the Doctors Without Borders hospitals to function all over the world in heavy crisis zones is precisely their nonpartisan position. They will treat anyone in need of medical care, regardless of what side they're on, regardless of what they did before they were injured, whether they are on the government side or the opposition side, whether they are civilians or military. They will treat anyone, but no weapons are allowed into the hospital. That's their ground rules. And it's enabled them to function all over the world. In this case, the soldiers came in, said, we don't care about your rules. They were firing into the air, trying to take three patients out with them. Several doctors stood to protect the patients, and after about an hour, they stood down and ultimately left the hospital. But it was clear they were very angry, this particular unit of the Afghan army. They were angry at this hospital for treating three injured people who they said, true or not, had been Taliban fighters. That would provide an explanation, not a justification, but an explanation of why they may have completely falsely called in the coordinates of this hospital, knowing it was a hospital, knowing it was the hospital that had stood them down, essentially, in a confrontation 3 months ago. Now, again, we don't have evidence to prove that that was, in fact, the case, but it does provide the kind of indication of what may have been going on. If that was the case, it means it was not an accident at all. It was an act of war. And if, as appears to be the case, the United States, whoever took the call from the Afghans saying we're taking fire, didn't check it against the known list of coordinates of hospitals, which had been provided to them just a couple of days earlier by the Doctors Without Borders staff, their specific coordinates, that means that the U.S. is then complicit in that action. And it may well be a war crime. It's true, it doesn't necessarily become a war crime when a civilian target is hit, but it certainly opens the possibility that it may well have been a war crime and that there must be an independent investigation to determine it.
Is there not some sense that this has happened before, that U.S. military has been sort of manipulated, if you will, to settle scores within Afghanistan?
Absolutely. This has been true in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in all of these places where the U.S. is relying on, often, maybe most of the time, very shaky intelligence fraught with corruption, fraught with personal vendettas. We know that people who have been arrested and spent years in prison in Guantanamo, in Bagram, in Abu Ghraib, often were people who were simply caught at the wrong place at the wrong time and were turned over to the Americans either to get a cash bounty that was being offered, to go after perhaps a neighbor to settle a longstanding land dispute. There's all kinds of indications of this kind of activity. And the fact that after 14 years, as you mentioned, this is the 14-year anniversary, if you will, of the war, the U.S. war in Afghanistan, this U.S. war in Afghanistan. There was an earlier one, of course. The fact that they don't take that seriously, knowing that this is exactly how this incredibly corrupt government and its incredibly non-accountable, corrupt military function is by itself a crime of some sort. I don't know if it's the kind of war crime that we're talking about here, but it's certainly should be some kind of a crime.
Well, John McCain's comment is clearly meant to say that there are good people and bad people. And I don't think it's putting it too crudely to say that the operative idea is that anything good people do is good and anything bad people do is bad. That's a powerful worldview because it's so simple. But many media readers know that, you know, the Taliban is the official enemy in Afghanistan, but we know that the U.S. has also worked with the Taliban, as we've been saying, paid them for security at times. I mean, a thoughtful person can be forgiven for just not understanding what the U.S. goal is in this now 14-year-old project, much less why horrific human impact should be accepted as in aid of that goal.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, Janine. And what we're looking at here is not only a situation where the U.S. has allied itself with the Taliban, we also have to look at the very small distinction between the Taliban and the so-called good guys in Afghanistan, who the U.S. military is supposedly protecting. So what does that mean? It means that when we talk, for example, about women's rights, what happens to women under the Taliban? What happens to women under the Taliban is horrific, period, full stop. Next sentence, what happens to women under the vast majority of the current Afghan government, put in place, armed, paid, supported by the United States, by our tax money, is horrific. Period. Full stop. Now, you can look at it and say, well, the Taliban is worse. And in some areas, that's probably true. But in other areas, it may not be. But I think we have to be clear that what has made the lives so terrible for women in Afghanistan is not only treatment by whether it's the Taliban or the warlords disguised as a government who now run Afghanistan, but rather the war itself in conjunction with that. That's what has made the lives of women in Afghanistan so impossible. Afghanistan remains the lowest ranked country in the world for a child to be born and to survive to her first birthday. So when we look at what the U.S. has brought about, $65 billion of our tax money has been spent to create and arm this Afghan army and police force that's supposed to be representing democracy and women's rights and all good things. Well, look what has happened under that military, under that government backing that military. Life is horrific for most Afghans. There's a small number of people in the cities, in Kabul in particular, who have benefited from the U.S. presence. There's no doubt about that. We shouldn't try to deny that.
some women are better off in the cities where lives are somewhat better protected. But the reality is that the vast majority of women in Afghanistan don't live in the cities. They live in small villages isolated across this vast country. They don't have access to the kinds of new institutions that have sprung up in very small scale in Kabul. And this is what has been left behind after 14 years of fighting. And now, of course, we hear that Obama's plan to have all the troops out beyond some hundred or maybe as much as 1,000 to protect the embassy after the end of 2016, that is now being reconsidered, and perhaps there will be thousands of troops left permanently engaged until who knows when Obama leaves office. So we're looking at permanent war on a whole new level.
I was just going to bring that up, that General John Campbell has said that Kunduz shows that we need more troops in Afghanistan after 2016. And that seems to be the typical, we're shaped like a hammer and everything looks like a nail. I mean, assuming some continued U.S. engagement, what might a political way forward look like beyond stopping dropping bombs on the country?
You know, the irony is that everybody acknowledges that at some point there will be a political, diplomatic solution to the crisis in Afghanistan. The real question is how many more people have to die before we get there? How many more years of fighting have to go on? How many more generations of young Afghans have to grow up knowing nothing but war before we finally get to the table? Will the Taliban have to be at the table? Of course they will, because they are a player. They are a force in this war. And as former Senator George Mitchell taught everybody after the Good Friday Accords, which he helped to lead, when he said the most important lesson coming out of this process is that if you're serious about diplomacy, everybody has to be at the table. Not because you like them, not because you think they've suddenly become good guys, but because if they're not at the table, they have no reason to abide by whatever is decided. If you're serious, everybody has to be there. That means the Taliban is going to have to be at the table. Does that mean compromises that are going to have to be made that we don't like? Of course it does. Of course it does. It's not our country. If the war was being fought in our country with an equivalent level of casualties, civilian casualties on a daily basis, I don't think there's any question that we would be demanding this kind of diplomacy, these kinds of negotiations. We need to have that now. And if that means that a government is created that is more religious than you or I might like to live under, that's the reality that we're going to have to deal with. It's not our country. We don't get to decide that we're going to have a nationally focused, strong national presence with a president and a parliament. That's never been the reality of Afghanistan. Afghanistan, unlike, say, Iraq, doesn't have a history of having a strong central leadership. It has a history of diffuse leadership, where the leadership includes a government but also includes religious figures. It includes women in local areas. It includes tribal leaders, all of whom are part of a complicated, culturally developed kind of governance that the U.S. has no understanding of. So when we try to put in place a replacement for that and say, nope, we're going to have a president and a parliament and a secretary of this and a secretary of that, and imagine that they're actually going to have influence outside of a little bit of Kabul, we're really deluding ourselves.
Well, let me just bring you back to Kunduz finally. U.S. public opinion seems to sometimes matter somewhat. You know, some moments are more teachable than others. Do we have hope for an independent investigation of this incident like Médecins Sans Frontières is calling for, though the Pentagon says they can investigate themselves? And then what use could be made from the results of such an investigation?
You know, I think there is right now the possibility, as you say, a teaching moment. This is something we used to call it the CNN factor. Sometimes we maybe now should call it the Twitter factor, but it's what happens when, for whatever reasons, a particular incident sparks a public reaction that hadn't happened before. It may be this time because the victims included international medical workers who have access to Twitter and Facebook and the internet and television and international broadcasting, and they speak English. That may be why. I'm maybe sounding a bit cynical, but that's okay if we can take advantage of that. This is not the first hospital to be hit in Afghanistan. Others have been hit before. Doctors have been killed before. But they were Afghan doctors, and they didn't generate the kind of response that this did. Now, does that mean that the demands, the very legitimate, really minimalist demands of Médecins Sans Frontières now for an independent investigation will go forward as they've requested? I'm guessing not, but I think there may be some effort to have some kind of international engagement. If there isn't, if the Pentagon insists we and we alone will carry out some kind of investigation, I think it's very possible that there will be the kind of informal investigations we've seen in the past, like the Russell Tribunal to the investigating the U.S. war in Vietnam, like the Russell Tribunals that have looked at the Israeli occupation and apartheid policies in recent years, or perhaps something in the United Nations, something equivalent to the Goldstone Report. The problem would be, of course, the refusal, very likely, by the Pentagon and the Obama administration to provide to any such investigation the necessary documents. We know, for example, that the warplane that was used to bomb the hospital has an audio recording in the plane. So that it's the equivalent of sort of a black box. Who gets access to that? Does it go into the public domain as it should? So I think these are all demands that are going to have to be part of the mobilization. There's a petition drive already underway that was organized by people at Credo and Win Without War and others of our colleagues and friends in the anti-war movement. Everybody should sign that petition. Sign every petition. Sign on to every call to members of Congress. Call members of Congress. That kind of campaign makes clear to those in Washington that this is not something that's going to go away easily with some Pentagon official saying, oh, we're sorry, now let's move on. We look to the future, not the past. Let's move on. There's no moving on from this kind of slaughter.
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Her most recent book is Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's email list. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Talk.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Now the time has come. Time, no place to run. Time, I get burned up by the sun. Time, when I have my fun. Time, I've been loved and put aside. Time, I've been crushed by tumbling time.
The time has come for many things, for peace, for climate action, for economic sanity. The list is long. This week on Radio EcoShock, we thunder into another place humans don't like to go. The nasty truth is we're killing off the only known living companions we have in this universe, as our first guest says. The venerable biologist and head of the Stanford Center for Biodiversity, Paul Ehrlich, joins us. He's followed by Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet. Will says you can't care about climate change and still eat meat, because about half of all global emissions are driven by the industrial slaughter of our fellow species. Too much information? Don't worry, be happy with this week's Climate Variety Hour.
In just 10 minutes.
Get inspired with Bernie Sanders, climate humor from UK's Guardian newspaper, and bits from climate songs by people who can actually sing. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Among stories of Middle East refugees and stock market jitters, we find brief notices that species are disappearing rapidly all over the world. In a scientific journal and a new book, famed scientists Paul and Anne Ehrlich warn that humans are driving the sixth great mass extinction here on Earth. Just released in September, their new book is titled The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. As an author and co-author of more than 40 books, Paul R. Ehrlich is the Bing Professor of Population Studies and the president of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University, and we reached him there. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be back.
Your book title uses the word annihilation. Is that just for sensationalism, or do you mean it?
Well, we mean it because basically we're losing the biodiversity of the planet, the only known living companions we have in the entire universe, and they're all critically important to us. Not every species, but virtually every population plays a role in the system that supports our lives. So, yeah, scientists are very scared about this. They're particularly scared because people don't really understand much about the threat. And that's too bad, but it's a big threat, just as big and involved with such things as climate change.
And you're right about the current times as the sixth great extinction. Can you tell us when the previous great dying of species happened and how serious was it?
Well, there are five previous ones. I can't enumerate every one right off the top of my head, but the one that virtually everybody has heard of occurred about 66 million years ago when an extraterrestrial object hit the Earth and wiped out, among other things, all the dinosaurs except for the birds, caused a horrendous decline in the diversity of life. Now, one of the things we have to remember is that was more than 65 million years before anything like a human being appeared on the planet. So what we're facing now is a catastrophic event, along with a civilization of more than 7 billion people trying to survive. So we're in a much different situation. The dinosaurs disappeared. Hopefully we won't.
How do we know, though, Paul, that these extinctions are being driven by humans rather than being part of some natural cycle so often found in Earth's long history?
Well, again, we have had five natural events, but the way we know that human beings are doing it now is simply a large set of observations plus correlations. We've looked at very conservative estimates of how many species we've lost over the last few hundred years. And we've looked at very conservative estimates of the rates of extinction that occurred between the mass extinction events. In other words, evolution is always going on. New species are always being formed, and they're many times going extinct. And there has been over all of our history a steady production of species and a steady loss of species as various things drove them extinct. But there are these five outstanding events when all of a sudden the rate of extinction went way, way, way up. And so what has been tested scientifically is, where is the rate of extinction today compared with the rate of extinction in the past that was standard, that was not in one of the great extinction episodes, that was a background rate, the one that was always going on? And looking conservatively at both ends of the story, it turns out that the extinction rate today is already somewhere between 10 and 100 or more times the background rate, which shows we're starting into a vast new extinction, and it's clearly being caused by human beings. I mean, virtually anybody who's looked at what's going on in nature can see that extinction is an ongoing process, because many species on the planet, maybe most of them, are losing populations all the time. And losing populations is how you become extinct. In other words, when the last population is gone, the species is extinct.
So how does this book relate to the scientific study on extinction you and Anne and Geraldo Ceballos published in June of this year in the journal Science Advances?
Well, the book and the paper are related to each other very closely. The book gives a lot more explanation for lay people of what the values we're losing are and where the losses are. We're trying to bring to people more of an emotional feel of what we're losing, because most people now are isolated in cities, don't know much about what goes on in the natural world, don't know where their food comes from. For example, one of the extinction problems that's very, very serious is the loss of pollinators that are necessary for our crops. If a person thinks that their food comes from the supermarket, they don't get what the real picture is. And for example, if we lost just the honeybees from North America, and they are in trouble, the cost to us in nutrition would be about $18 billion and a considerable loss in the nutritional value of our diets. And yet, if the honeybees just disappeared from North America, there would be no species extinction, just an extinction of populations. So you got to look at the world as that supports us as running by the populations of millions of species, and we're losing the populations rapidly, and losing the populations leads eventually to the loss of the species. By the time a species is endangered, the value of the populations to human beings is way down. For example, if we had killed off all the honeybees except one population in Central Africa where they originated, we still wouldn't have lost the species, but we would have lost all the pollination services worth many billions of dollars. So you can't just look at it as loss of species. You got to look at it as loss of biodiversity.
Now, in a review of your new book in the Los Angeles Times, Fred Pierce says there have been only 800 extinctions registered in the last 400 years. He thinks you're being too emotional about all this, Paul. What do you say?
Well, first of all, I am emotional about it. Second of all, poor Fred Pierce is a very confused man and has been for a long time. He, for example, says that the only problem is not population size, it's just per capita consumption. He doesn't seem to understand the two multiply together, and saying something like that is like saying the area of a rectangle is the fault of the width, not the length. We say in the book that you don't have to know we're losing biodiversity because we're losing habitat any more than we have to know what every grain of sand on the beach is in order to know a beach is eroding away. And he says, no, you got to count the grains of sand. In other words, he does not understand the environment. He does not understand science. But for some reason, he gets to publish nonsense. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, we know they're climate deniers. Do you think there are also developing extinction deniers?
there are people who don't want to face that we're facing an existential challenge in climate, in loss of biodiversity, in what we're doing with toxics, in the plastic microparticles problem that's developing, and so on. And the scientific community has been very forthcoming on this, and yet you may have noticed there have been a couple of debates in which no serious problem has been discussed. Haven't talked at all about the population problem, about the climate problem, about the toxics problem, about the extinction problem, and so on. And yet these are what concern the people who are really interested in seeing that our civilization persists.
I thought birds would be the great survivors. They can move away from threats towards better living zones, but your team writes that they are in trouble. Why is that?
Well, they can move, but unfortunately, we're destroying the places they can move to very often. We're also putting up barriers that prevent them from moving as far and as fast as they'd like to. In other words, there are all kinds of problems with the refueling stations for the tropical birds that spend the summer in North America and then return to the tropics. So some birds are very, very resilient. Others aren't. That's a general story with animals. That is, some are more easily threatened by things like climate change than others. And all these problems are tied tightly together because, of course, extinction of populations of trees is now increasing our chances of more climate change. So this is a huge nexus of problems that everybody should be educated about, but which, unfortunately, most of our politicians are not. And that's one of the things we're hoping to do in the annihilation of nature is bring it home in a more personal way to see what the birds and mammals are that are under threat, why they're under threat, and what that means to us, and what we might be able to do to change it.
And animals most like us, carnivore hunters, are becoming extinct first and foremost. Could you tell us, Paul, about a couple of the great creatures in jeopardy and their chances for survival?
Well, one good example, an iconic animal, is the lion, whose populations are declining rapidly. They used to extend all the way to India from Africa, but now they're refined, except for a very few in one part of India. They're confined to Africa, and they're suffering from distemper, from domestic dog contacts. They're being hunted still in places, and unfortunately, their bones are now being featured in Chinese medicine. Same thing with the black rhinoceros, which is now so endangered in South Africa that they're shipping their black rhinos to Botswana, which is in Africa the best country in terms of how they deal with conservation, because poaching is so critical on the black rhinos because their horns are thought to be aphrodisiacs in Chinese medicine. And they're also supposed to be aphrodisiacs when you make them into daggers for the Middle East. And one of the saddest things I've heard recently is we thought Viagra might save the rhino because Viagra actually works. But it turns out now the dealers are grinding Viagra into the rhino horn so that the rhino horn really works. So those are a couple of famous cases of things that are in deep trouble, but there are many, many others.
Wow, that's pitiful. You know, here in Canada, Paul, we just had a hockey player charged for taking macho pictures of himself with a grizzly bear he illegally slaughtered. And then there's the dentist who shot Cecil the lion. Is this partly just a testosterone problem, as you've been speaking about?
Well, I think you can imagine my opinion of the dentist. And, you know, if you want to actually be a sportsman, then go hunt a lion with a .22 rifle, maybe, and not with somebody guarding you. But it's unfortunate, I have to say, or I shouldn't say it's unfortunate. The hunting is a minor factor compared to destruction of habitat and the things I was talking about in Africa, the poaching on the rhinos, and particularly rhinos and elephants are in trouble because of the market in rhino horn and in ivory. There's an animal called the scaly anteater. There's another name for them which skips my mind now, but there's 13 species that are being killed all over the world because the scales play a role in Chinese medicine. So there's a huge trade in wildlife, but hunting per se is mostly serious when poor people hunt for bushmeat. And, of course, that's another problem that we have to face, that there are a lot of people in the world who don't have enough to eat. And if you don't have enough to eat, It's the ground pangolin. The pangolin is his name I was coming up with. But they are hunted. The pangolins are hunted to be eaten. They're a delicacy in parts of China. But, again, there are a lot of poor people who get their food directly from nature. It's called bushmeat. And who can blame them? We got to find ways to control that trade and make sure everybody has a decent diet, which we don't do at the moment.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith, talking with the famous ecologist Paul R. Ehrlich about our destruction of Earth's other creatures. Well, you mentioned habitat loss, Paul. In a developed world, we may not slaughter species directly, but we steal their habitat for resources, new shopping malls, and suburbs. Why isn't there a plan to save the species, or is there one?
Well, there is, some countries pay more attention than we do. Botswana is way ahead of the United States in conservation. Mexico is way ahead of the United States in conservation. But in the United States, a strip mall is always valued more than habitat for organisms that we either appreciate or that are part of our life support system. And that's sad. And again, it's not debated. In other words, most people don't know there's a real conservation problem, don't know that we're entering the great extinction crisis that could end our civilization. And that's sad. That's why I'm raving at you on the radio.
Did you go into how climate change will speed up this extinction event in your book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Several things are missing from the media. For example, have you heard anybody point out that the more people there are, the greater the climate change is going to be, because each person contributes greenhouse gases to the atmosphere? The climate population connection has not been made. The population extinction connection has not been made. And the connection between climate change and extinction, because, of course, climate change changes habitats very rapidly. I mean, we're for instance, right now on the West Coast in California, I think in British Columbia as well, the forests are being changed dramatically by drought and new fire regimes, and that means the inhabitants of those forests are going to have great trouble and are going to be more threatened with extinction.
Do you think it's possible that DNA from disappearing species could be saved to bring them back later in a more ecologically sane world? Is such a project in the works?
Well, there are some people trying to do that, but it's actually a total waste of time. The basic thing is it's so much easier to save the habitat while it still exists and save the organisms while they still exist. The so-called de-extinction movement is basically made work for idiots. And it's one of the saddest things because, I like Jurassic Park. Great movie, but scientifically nonsense. And that is something that's being it has a huge threat, because it makes people who are ignorant of science believe they don't have to worry, because all we have to do is put the several billion populations we have on the planet now that are genetically different in freezers and everything will be fine.
Well, we've just received a new study saying that half the fish in the sea have disappeared since you and I were born. It's just another brief headline, though, Paul, competing with Hollywood news and the stock market. How can giant and dangerous trends like the ones we're talking about get past that everyday roar of sensational media?
Well, I think you would say probably for you and for me, if we knew how, we'd sure as hell do it. We keep trying. But I was once told by Ben Bradley that I had suggested to him that the Washington Post every day put in numbers about how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere, how big the human population was, how many people were starving, and so on. And he told me, no. He says, we don't want to have numbers in the newspaper. Nobody likes numbers. And I said, have you ever looked at the sports or the financial pages? And he said, well, he kind of backed off on that. But then he told me that he wanted his science reporters to be utterly ignorant of science so they could be unbiased. And I said, do you hire sports reporters who don't know what a strike and a ball is? The media has serious, serious problems, as I think you know.
Yep. Well, in your book, there's a lot of gorgeous photographs. How were they selected and why are they there?
Well, the whole idea is to make people know what we're losing. Most people don't pay attention. And so we selected what we thought were a lot of attractive and interesting animals. We took some of our own favorite pictures. There's one in there of one of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen that I wish every human being had a chance to see, with something like 3,000 wildebeest, a herd of about 3,000 wildebeest storming into the Mara River and crossing as fast as possible so they can avoid being eaten by crocodiles. And that's the kind of scene that, you know, we had an abundance on the planet during the Pleistocene, is very rare today, ought to be preserved, and we ought to find ways to get as many people to see it as possible. But short of seeing it, a movie or a picture is the best we can do.
So you're the head of a Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford. What are the steps needed to save what species are remaining, and what agencies need to take leadership in this?
Well, the most basic steps, of course, as we've published many times, is to reduce the scale of the human enterprise. There are many too many people, and they are consuming much too much, many of them, and too many of them don't have enough to eat, so they don't consume enough. And so unless we have to tackle the population and consumption problem and the notion that we can grow forever, the you know, we have this faith-based economic system which says on a finite planet we can continue to grow forever and not worry about anything. And those are the fundamental things that need to be changed. A lot of scientists are trying to change them. A very famous climate scientist has gone to jail trying to get people to close down coal-fired plants, which we should be doing immediately. Those are the main things to do while we do the standard conservation things in hopes of saving some of the parts, because it's going to take a long time to humanely reduce the size of the human population, to convince people they don't have to have 50 new iPhones every day, and so on and so forth. So we got a lot to do, and unhappily, there are not many people doing it.
Now, Paul Ehrlich, you don't have a reputation for looking on the bright side of things. Is there any hope for the threatened animal life, or do we just shrug it off and hope it never gets to us?
I got a standard answer for that. I think I used to say that I am very pessimistic about where we're going, but I'm very optimistic about where we could go. I now would say I'm still optimistic about where we could go if we choose to do so, but my pessimism is increased by such things as having political debates in which the critical existential issues are not even discussed. So, yeah, there's a lot we could do. Boy, we could start right now, and it would cheer me up and cheer up my colleagues very much. But we're not doing it. In other words, we're still not making the big changes in the use of fossil fuels we should. We still have people who think that it's okay to have 5 children. Matter of fact, it may not even be okay to have 2 anymore. So when we hear population discussed in the U.S. like it is, say, in Australia, I'll become more cheery, but I'm not looking forward to it.
And do we hide this fear of annihilation from school children? What do we tell the kids?
Well, what we have to tell the kids is it's going to be in their laps. These changes, we're leaving them a world that is in tough shape, and part of their job is going to be to have to help dig us out of it. You know, I love talking to the people in middle school and so on, where they haven't yet formed their views but can understand everything. And children can be a big force for conservation. You know, when the Exxon Valdez oil spill occurred, the kids of the Exxon executives in Alaska gave them hell. They came home and said, "Daddy, why is your company doing this? We need more of that."
So as we wrap up, is there anything I've missed, Paul, that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I'd like to leave with the listeners that they shouldn't take my word on it. That they should look in the literature, see what the scientific community says, learn about these problems, and then do something about it. I think every functional human being who is rich enough not to have to just worry about where his or her food is coming from should be putting something like 10% of their time into one of the many places in which people can act. If you want to do something, go to mahb.stanford.edu, mahb.stanford.edu. Become a mobster and help save the world.
We've been talking about disappearing nature with the renowned ecologist Paul R. Ehrlich, with the Mexican ecologist Geraldo Ceballos. Paul and Ann Ehrlich have just released their new book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. You can find links to the book and the science behind this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul Ehrlich, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure as always. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. It's not too hard to get sympathy for the awful killing of iconic animals in the wild. Everybody loves the elephants, lions, and tigers. It's a lot harder to get anyone to listen to the awful truth about our treatment of the animals, those animals who tolerate humans the most, the gentle cows, intelligent pigs, and docile chickens. In the United States alone, 75 million animals are killed every day for the meat diet that is scientifically documented to make people sick and fat. 2 out of every 3 Americans are overweight or obese. It's an epidemic that is spreading throughout the world. Many of our listeners know climate change is real and not a good thing, yet we try not to know that at least half of all greenhouse gas emissions come not from cars or factories, but from the far-flung empire of animal agriculture. If you don't believe it, get ready for the man who blows up the lies behind what we eat.
Radio EcoShock.
What is at the root of our violence towards nature, our indifference to changing the climate, and our murderous relationship with all the other species? Will Tuttle says he knows. Actually, that's Dr. Will Tuttle. His PhD comes from the University of California in Berkeley. Tuttle is a blazing speaker at conferences organized by vegetarians, animal rights activists, and progressive spiritualists. He also helped organize events like the online Vegan Palooza in 2012. A listener suggested Will Tuttle for Radio EcoShock, and I admit I had my doubts. Until I listened to a couple of his YouTube presentations, he is on to something big that you should hear. Will Tuttle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, so much for having me, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
Well, I've been working on animal rights off and on this program, although it's not our major feature. Mostly we talk about climate change, and I'm always looking for the big picture, though, people that can clarify the right direction for action. And I know you've got that, but let's build up to it a bit. Let's start with, what set a younger Will Tuttle on your path of compassion for the animals?
Well, briefly, you know, I was raised in a typical family here in the States back in the 1950s in Concord, Massachusetts, eating the usual meals, lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and never questioning it. When I was maybe 7 years old, I said to my mother, so the food we're eating, is this what everybody eats? And my mother said, yep, this is what everybody eats. And then she came back a few minutes later, and she said, well, actually, there are vegetarians. And I had never heard that word in my life, but she said, don't worry, you'll never meet one. And she said, I've never met one, and I don't know where they get their protein. So I basically learned at that point that vegetarians are hypothetical people. And my mother was totally right. I went through life. I used to go away in the summers up to Vermont to the summer camp where it was affiliated with a small organic dairy, and we would slaughter our own chickens and slaughter the cows ourselves. And so I participated in all of that, and I think I did it, of course, because I was a product of my community and my family and my society, and I knew that this is what you were supposed to do. But to make a long story short, after college, in my early 20s, I ended up going on a kind of like a spiritual pilgrimage. I just didn't want to go right into working, and so I wandered a little bit around the United States. This was in the mid-1970s, and I ended up at the time the largest hippie commune in the world. Actually, it was called The Farm. It was about 900 people living there in Tennessee. Most of them were from California, actually. And they were all vegetarians. And actually, I think today we would probably call them vegans because they didn't eat dairy products or eggs either. And they were not dying of a protein deficiency. They probably had about 200 kids that were thriving, and they were all vegan from birth, basically. So I realized that it's not necessary to eat animal foods because of this living example that I was living there with these people. And when I found out, when I asked them why, and they told me that basically because we feed most of the grain and food that we're growing, we feed the animals and eat their flesh and secretions while people are starving. And when I learned that, and also they talked a little bit about the abuse of the animals that they endure by the millions every day. And so I think at the same time, you know, being able to eat meals with them, that was it. I never had eaten meat again in my life since that day back in 1975, 40 years ago. And then about 5 years later, I learned about the cruelty to cows and hens. And so I became a vegan in 1980. And a few years later, I was able to go to a Zen monastery in Korea. I lived as a Zen monk, actually, in Korea and did a lot of meditation back in the 80s. And found myself actually for the second time in my life in a community that was vegan, but they didn't call it vegan either, but there was no meat or dairy or eggs or wool or silk or leather or anything. And it was essentially a practice they'd been engaging in for probably 700 or 800 years, primarily for, I would say, spiritual and ethical reasons, not to cause suffering to others. So that was it for me. I think really the main reason I was eating meat was because of the communities I was raised in. And the main way I was able to get out of it, actually, was these communities, these two communities that I experienced living in. And since then, I've discovered that eating animal foods is devastating to our environment, as well as to our society, and I would say also to our health and and the inner landscape of our consciousness.
Well, now, Will, we've just talked with the famous biologist Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He and his wife Anne have a new book saying we are annihilating wild mammals and birds. Is that along with your thinking?
No question about it. It's we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of other species in 65 million years, driven essentially by one thing, people taking out their wallets and paying for meat, dairy products, and eggs. That's the driving force, because what's driving the force of the mass extinction of species is loss of habitat, destruction of habitat, destruction of rainforest, destruction of oceans. And what's driving that, we're cutting down about an acre per second right now of rainforest. And that's not, there's one reason for it. We're growing soy, basically growing soy to feed the factory farm pigs and cows and chickens. And also, people don't realize it, but factory farm fish eat huge amounts of soy too. Which are the fish are then usually fed to other fish or fed to cows and pigs and chickens. But anyway, we're cutting down rainforests. We're overfishing the oceans. I just read the other day we've lost over half of the animals in the oceans in the last 50 years are gone. So that's all from meat and dairy and fish eating. That's it. That's the driving force.
Well, I suppose we're ready for the heavier stuff, except most of us are never really ready to talk or even to hear about our treatment of agricultural animals. How does that taboo reach even into people who otherwise consider themselves progressive and caring humans?
Well, I think, you know, Alex, the thing is very similar probably to living in, say, South Carolina back in the 1820s, you know, where you'd go to church every Sunday and the minister would preach in glowing terms about what a wonderful world we live in, where everything is in order, and the white people are superior, and the black people are inferior, and they're here to serve us and to be our slaves, and this is the way it is. You know, this is the wonderful world we live in. And we may be progressive, you know, in a certain way, but we are all essentially injected with a narrative from the time we're little kids. And the most powerful way we're injected with the official stories of our society are through the mealtime rituals. We sit down for breakfast, lunch, and dinner from the time of little infants, and we eat the flesh and secretions of horribly abused and tortured animals. We don't just watch the adults eating it. You know, we have to eat it ourselves, too. We're forced into it. And so that basically shuts down, I think, in many ways, our critical ability in this situation. We're just not able to look at it, and we have these overtones of feelings of security and respect for our parents and all these things. So it just causes a lot of cognitive dissonance and affective dissonance. We just get very uncomfortable thinking about the horrible abuse that we're causing when we take out our wallets and pay for meat, dairy products, and eggs to people who are starving, to the animals who are suffering so terribly, to wildlife, which is being completely destroyed by ranching and animal agriculture, to slaughterhouse workers that have to stab animals every day and who do work that brings out the worst in them, who have the highest rates of worker-related injuries, as well as drug addiction, alcohol abuse, spousal abuse, and so forth. And so the violence in animal agriculture is far greater than anything else we're doing, but we're genteel people, we're progressive people. It's very easy for us to just cover it over and not talk about it because that's what 97% of the people are doing, basically. So it's time, I think, just to, you know, understand that and realize that if we want to have an earth that we're going to leave to our children, then we have to begin to become more conscious and mindful of the consequences of our actions.
You know, Will, when I was 13, I found a book on my granddaddy's shelf, and it was a horrifying collection of photos from the Holocaust. And nobody told me that there was industrialized murder of humans. And hearing you talk about what happens on big business farms, as they call them, especially the concentrated food lot operations, it reminds me of the Holocaust. Is there a comparison there to be made?
Yeah, I think, it's very clear. I mean, the original word itself, Holocaust, literally means whole burning. And it was originally meant the whole burning of animals for food and the killing and stabbing of animals. That's what the Holocaust literally is. I mean, that's what it actually is. And then the ways that were developed to dismember animals in an assembly line or disassembly line is probably a better word for it. Fashion was actually the foundation of Henry Ford and his assembly lines and all that, but also really the foundational paradigm that was followed by the Nazis in Germany, too, using the same cattle cars to ship the people in and using similar types of mass killing that had been practiced on animals already. So, you know, psychologists understand very well. I mean, they understand very well that anyone who is a mass murderer of people always practices on animals first. That anyone, that if a child grows up and abuses animals and is allowed to do that, very often they will grow up to do the same thing to other people. And we have a society where we're basically, just in the United States alone, for example, we're killing 75 million animals every single day. Now, this is a huge killing machine that just numbs us. And so how can we expect, if we're willing and able to, each one of us, contribute to this, to killing so many animals, that we would not that we would fail to stop the killing machine of other human beings, that we have nuclear weapons, that we can kill each other many times over, we have wars continuing, prisons. The whole violent system essentially is founded upon the daily killing and abuse of animals for food.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Will Tuttle, the author of The World Peace Diet, and we'll be talking about that shortly. What about the animal agriculture and climate change? Are there solid links there?
Yeah, that's another thing that I think is all too often glossed over. There's a new movie called Cowspiracy, which I think really helps to show a little bit of how this works. But basically, you know, animal agriculture uses enormous amounts of petroleum. People don't realize that. Also, enormous amounts of water. We're talking about 1,000 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of milk, for example. And the cows that are used in all animals, actually, pigs and chickens as well, they emit enormous quantities of methane as well as nitrous oxide. Methane is about 70 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and nitrous oxide is about 300 times more powerful. And as well as the fact that we're cutting down the rainforests, which are the lungs of the earth, And also the oceans are being destroyed by the runoff and also the acidification caused by animal agriculture, the nutrient-rich runoff from fertilizer. So altogether, this is driving global climate change more than any other activity. The World Bank, I think as people know, Anhang and Goodland, did in their research, found that animal agriculture is a full 51% of all human activity. I mean, you know, animal agriculture is the leading cause of climate destabilization. And right here where I'm standing right now in Northern California, just, you know, a week ago, there were fires raging all around me. Right here, I saw my own neighbor's houses burning in flames. We lost 1,500 homes right here. And the scientists at UC Berkeley just recently said that it has never been this dry and hot in California in over 500 years. This is unprecedented. And so the actual destruction of, we've had 150,000 acres of forest has burned here just in the last 2 months, and killing people and destroying homes. I mean, global climate destabilization by animal agriculture, if we don't wake up to what we're doing, we're not going to have a world for our children, even probably for ourselves.
Wow. So tell us about the World Peace Diet. Is it a printed book? Is it an audio book or what?
Yeah, the World Peace Diet actually came out exactly 10 years ago. This is the 10th year anniversary, and it was a number one Amazon bestseller in 2010. And it's available as an audiobook, as an ebook. It's also been translated now into, I think we're up to about 18 languages worldwide. So we just got back actually from doing some lectures in Austria, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, and so forth. And it's just wonderful to see, I think, that there is an awakening to the underlying message, which is that our mistreatment of animals for food is actually a mistreatment of the earth as well as ourselves, and that each one of us can make a positive change. So the book is available. It's out there in many languages, and I go into these ideas much more, I think, much more in depth and probably a lot more, a lot better said too than I speak in.
Well, you're doing pretty great, I think. Is it natural for cows to eat meat or fish? And what happens when they do?
Yeah, that's another thing that people don't realize. You know, fortunately, people are starting to talk about it, but cows actually are eating more fish than human beings in the United States, because scientists discovered actually decades ago that it's profitable to enrich the feed of cows with fish meal, along with other things. Roadkill and a whole lot of other stuff is all ground up at the renderers. So this pushes the cows unnaturally, not only to fatten up for beef, but also to give more milk than they normally would. And it's not natural for them. It causes all kinds of problems. It's the driving force really behind E. coli, which is, you know, also causing a lot of trouble for human beings because there's feces that's embedded in the flesh of meat. That's pretty well known. So it's very important, I think, to realize that the way that we're raising these animals, feeding them and breeding them and so forth, is not only unnatural, it's profoundly abusive, that they suffer from the time they're born till the time they die, and if they're killed at very young ages. So it's really a slaughter of infants. And the only ones that live a little bit longer are the dairy cows. They live maybe 4 years, 4 years of misery, and are repeatedly impregnated against their will and have their babies stolen, and their babies are killed. Three out of the four will be killed. Only one will be allowed to be a slave like her mother on the dairy. So on any dairy, organic or not, it's essentially a rape and kill operation, giving us foods that we are not designed. We don't have renin like little calves have, which is the basic enzyme that we would need to break down casein, which is the main protein in milk. So the whole driving force behind autoimmune diseases, most of the childhood problems like runny noses and earaches and sore throats and tonsillitis and appendicitis and all these things are directly linked to dairy. So it's a great boon to the pharmaceutical medical industry to have this thing going, but it's just so much suffering to the female animals and to their babies.
Now, as a vegan, you say it's not natural for humans to eat meat either. I know many listeners will be doubtful about that. Have there been scientific studies that found early humans, say before the agricultural revolution, did not eat meat? I mean, didn't cavemen eat meat and hunt the woolly mammoths into extinction?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. You know, it's very interesting. Just lately, as people do more and more research, the story's always changing. And I think it's important to always remember that our understanding of history, even what happened on 9/11, we don't really know. We have official stories. And the same thing is true, I think, when we go back to prehistory, we have official stories. Those have been changing a lot in the last few years as we have realized, actually, a few important things. One is that the early humans going back 400,000 years ago, going way back, have amylase, which is essentially the enzyme that only does one thing in our saliva, and that is break down complex carbohydrates that are found in starches. So now the whole official story of anthropologists is undergoing a radical change, that human beings did not eat much meat. They ate very, very little meat. Maybe 4% of their diet was meat. 96% of their diet was fruits and starches, starchy tubers, and things that they could gather. And this was reliable food, and we can tell that from the DNA, from the saliva amylase DNA genetic composition. So the whole idea that we are naturally supposed to be eating meat, you can tell from our physiology. I mean, we have a physiology that's not designed for meat. I mean, I go into this in depth in the World Peace Diet, but essentially we can eat meat, like cows. Cows can eat meat, you know, but it's not good for them. But, they can fatten up and get sick, you know, eating meat. But, you know, it's the same thing with us. We can do it, but our body would much rather have starch and vegetables and fruits and grains and nuts. These are the things we're designed to eat.
And what about the people who say they crave meat? I mean, people love the smell of bacon. You can have bacon peanut butter, probably bacon toothpaste for all I know. Doesn't that suggest that human meat eating is natural?
Well, you know, people crave a lot of things. I mean, if you had kids forced into smoking cigarettes from the time they were infants, they would probably crave smoking tobacco. They would say it smells so good. You know, they would just really want to do it. This doesn't mean it's natural. It doesn't mean it's healthy. If you just go to any grocery store and look at the baby food section, you will see these little jars of beef and turkey and chicken and veal and cheese. I mean, that's what we're given from the time we're little kids. That's why we like it. It's because we're forced into it. You know, for me, after 40 years, if I smell meat, it's disgusting. I mean, there's something hideous about it. You know, if you were to tell someone, well, could you give up eating bacon? They say, no, I could never give that up. It's so delicious. And then you say, well, could you give up eating dog? And they say, what are you talking about? That's disgusting. And yeah, I remember when I was a Zen monk in Korea, and I asked a guy if he could give up eating dog. He said, no way. I love dog. Could you give up eating beef? Oh, I would never eat that. That's disgusting. Now, it's just cultural programming. That's all.
So are there vegan cultures in the world, and are they healthy?
My feeling is that it has happened before. I talk about it in the World Peace Diet. There was a great revolution that happened on this planet, the herding revolution, when we started owning animals as property for food. And that culture brought in slavery. It brought in war. It brought in the domination of women and patriarchy. And it's based on dominating animals for food. And that is the culture we're born in. And that culture has taken over the whole planet for the last basically 10,000 years. So I think it's hard to see other cultures now, but I think it is possible, if we look back historically, to find remnants of sane, compassionate, and environmentally sustainable cultures. And I think the future for us as human beings is definitely to move in that direction.
So could we make this big change? I mean, what would the world look like with a vegan human population?
Oh, my gosh, that's an incredibly good question. I think it's just, you know, if you just want to have a beautiful moment, just sit back and imagine a vegan world. Because if imagining a vegan world is imagining a completely different society, utterly different. We can't even probably comprehend it. A world based on kindness and respect for creation, for the whole beautiful and abundant earth, for ecosystems, for animals, for each other, a world based on sustainability. We can feed everyone on this planet on a tiny fraction of the land. My wife, Madeline, and I lived for 17 years in an RV. We saw that most of the land has been enslaved to monocrop corn and soy to feed to these cows and pigs and chickens that are stuck away in these stinking sheds where they never see the light of day. So a vegan world there would be none of that. The prisons would be free. The animal prisons would be free. The war would be destroyed. We'd be healthy and radiant. We could feed everyone on local agriculture. We could have local economies where we support each other. We could grow food that really heals us. You know, we have a garden. We have a food forest here now, and we've only been here a few years, but we've built a food forest. We saw people in Canada that were doing that. And when you just make a connection to the earth, you grow your own food, you're feeding life with life. The food will heal us and support us. We can feed everyone, as I say, on a fraction of the land. The streams could come back. The rivers could come back. The oceans could come back. Animals could come back. Instead of being a curse on this planet like we are now, we could find our place. We could live our purpose as blessing the world rather than destroying it.
How do we find like-minded people who can help us make the change away from killing animals for food?
I think the best way to find these like-minded people is to be one ourselves. You know, that's what I've discovered. When I make the change myself authentically, when I question the official stories and move to a plant-based diet for ethical reasons, then I create a field around me of freedom, of peace, of joy, of love, of caring, of kindness, compassion, empathy, sustainability, liberation. And I become a magnet for other people who have a similar interest. And I just start meeting them here and meeting them there. And pretty soon we can create meetups. We can create alternative communities. We create a movement. It's a grassroots movement that's invisible to the mass media pretty much. But it's definitely growing. I've been giving 150 events a year now for many years, all over the United States, North America, the world, actually now Australia, New Zealand, China, everywhere, Europe. And basically, it's a massive movement that's growing, and it's the most important movement on this planet is the vegan movement, the movement for compassion and kindness and sustainability based not just on theorizing about it, but actually living it in the most crucial way, which is our daily meals. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where we're actually voting for what the kind of world we want to have, and if we're going to be heartless and murder and kill other living beings, or if we're going to be kind and compassionate and realize that we live in a world that's essentially, potentially benevolent, that we can live with kindness and love and caring on this planet. And then I think instead of being afraid of us, the animals would become our friends.
Listeners, do you want to free the animals and your own mind and conscience along with it? Try the work of Dr. Will Tuttle and the World Peace Diet. It's all at willtuttle.com. Will, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex.
In that interview, Will Tuttle quotes the figure of 51% of climate change emissions driven by animal agriculture. He cites a study by Robert Goodlin and Jeff Anhang. The title is Livestock and Climate Change. You can Google that, or you can find a link to that study in my show blog at ecoshock.info, which is published every Wednesday. All right, it's time for the Climate Variety Hour.
In just 10 minutes.
For folks trained by the tweetosphere, here are some of the climate sounds that zipped past my ears this week, some of them thanks to tips from Radio EcoShock listeners. Tired of Republican climate deniers and Democratic wafflers? Here's a minute and a half from Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders in a speech to enthusiastic, mostly African-American college students at Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina. That was September 9th, 2015.
And when we talk about important issues facing our country, we have got to understand that as adults, we have a moral responsibility to make certain that we leave this planet healthy and habitable for our kids and our grandchildren. And I want everybody here to know, because I sit on both the Environmental Committee and the Energy Committee in the U.S. Senate, and I've talked to a lot of scientists over the years, the debate is over within the scientific community. Climate change is real. Climate change is caused by human activity. Climate change today is already causing devastating problems in our country and all over the world. And in my view, if we are concerned about our kids and our grandchildren, we have got to do everything that we can to lead the effort, work with China, Russia, India, and other countries in transforming this planet's energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
In the United Kingdom, the Guardian newspaper has been showing what climate-responsible media can really be. If you've wondered when the coastal real estate market will crash, here is a Guardian vignette as we enter an oversized house with the local realtor.
All right, of course, you've got this beautiful deck. It looks directly out onto the beach. I mean, you guys would be out of your minds not to take this place. I mean, truly out of your minds.
I just don't see how this can possibly be in our price range.
Yeah, there's got to be a catch.
The only catch in this place is the catch of the day, which you're going to be catching from your private beach.
There's actually an enormous catch. This house is doomed.
I mean, I know it looks perfect, but the sea levels are rising fast. Ever heard of a little thing called global warming? Climate change? Planet Hottywood? Yeah, in a few years, the only people living in this house are gonna be turtles. But, I mean, that ain't gonna stop me from selling it. With the polar ice caps melting, the East Coast is being swallowed by the Atlantic Ocean. That's where I come in, selling homes to unsuspecting buyers who have no idea that they're on cursed land.
That's from the Guardian newspaper climate site. Find the video link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. If rising seas will swallow the East Coast, just as the climate-driven rains did this past week, maybe we need somewhere higher to go. Here is the Guardian newspaper's fake promo for the city that is safe from rising seas.
Denver, Colorado, a scenic metropolis on the doorstep of the Rocky Mountains. With a healthy economy and a growing population, Denver provides a great place for young people to start a future. Also, pot is totally legal. But what you may not know is when sea levels rise in 50 years due to climate change, Denver is also one of the highest cities in America and a prime candidate to be the capital of the world. Yes, many young people understand that their futures don't just depend on a city with a good economy and fun lifestyle. It also needs to not be completely underwater.
I mean, the Hunger Games totally nailed it.
Why live in a place that's going to be somewhere in the ocean in 50 years?
I'll have beachfront property eventually.
Why would I want to have a shark as a roommate?
I don't want our kids going to school with shark kids.
Also, pot's totally legal.
This is how I deal with climate change.
So what are you waiting for? Do what so many are already doing and move to Denver, the future capital of the world.
We'll close out the Guardian Climate Media with just a brief sample from New Orleans musicians Tom Henahan and David S. Lewis. They've had the climate change blues ever since Hurricane Katrina nearly drowned their city.
Now the world's getting hotter. California's in a drought. And not enough people know what they should do about it. If we lose our coastal cities, will we keep on hitting snooze? Will we save our planet or get the climate change blues now? The climate change blues, baby. The climate change blues, honey. Everyone's gonna lose with the climate change blues now. Tell me where we're stopping. Oh, what will we choose? Tell me, will we save our planet or get the climate change blues?
Find a link to the song Climate Change Blues at the Guardian newspaper or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. The whole series was sponsored by a progressive ice cream company. Now, I know music is a very personal thing. What I like, you may hate, and vice versa. That's why I leave my push for climate change music to the end of the show. Don't be afraid. I'm not going to try to sing. This week, we have real musicians, the Cantrells. From Nashville, Tennessee, Al and Emily Cantrell perform Goodbye, Cool World. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to Radio EcoShock, and be sure and tune in next week.
Remember the breeze, it felt so nice. Felt like the wind blowing over the ice. No ice, but it was all gone in the blink of an eye. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. I remember the sun before the drought. Back in the days when we used to go out. No doubt, now we stay inside and hide from the sky. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Why, baby, didn't we open our eyes to the ghost of the future of human demise? Who would have thought back in 2013 we'd go extinct? Cause we wouldn't go green. I remember the earth, my home, sweet home. Now it's 200 degrees in Nome. No home, could I bike, could I hike? We just didn't try. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Thank you. sudden demise. Who would have thought back in 2013 we'd go extinct because we wouldn't go green? I remember the Earth, my starter home. Now I'm in space living under a dome. No home. Could I biked, could I hiked? We just didn't try. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Could I biked, could I hiked? We just didn't try. Goodbye. Adios, we're toast. Our feet are saying there's too much rain. Sayonara, somebody put out the fire. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
Intifada Electronic.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. On October 9th, hundreds of students from all over the U.S. will be converging at the 5th annual National Students for Justice in Palestine conference, hosted this year at San Diego State University. This year's conference is themed From Campuses to Communities, Building a Vision for the Future, and aims, as National SJP says, to reflect on our role as student activists within the larger scheme of a worldwide struggle for Palestinian rights, situating our work in both regional and global contexts. Joining us to talk about this year's conference and the growth of the student movement in support of Palestinian rights is Sami Suleiman. Sami is a PhD student at Brown University and is on the steering committee of National Students for Justice in Palestine. He joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Sami, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So there's so much to talk about when it comes to the student Palestine solidarity movement right now. Let's begin with having you assess where the National Structure for Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, is in terms of its growth and the mainstreaming of student Palestine activism on college campuses.
Yeah, so the structure of National Students for Justice in Palestine has always been in an ad hoc nature. We never have strived to be a governing structure of any sort. Our main focus is coordinating activity and allowing and facilitating SJPs across the country to share resources and skills with each other so that we can be all more effective in our local campuses and regions. And at the moment, for this conference, we're striving to expand our ability to do that by coming up with a more concrete structure that'll make us even more democratic, even more representative, and even more effective, more importantly.
And about how many chapters of SJP are there nationwide at this point?
There are well over 100 at this point. The number of SJPs is increasing every year. It's hard to keep track of all of them because there isn't a system of keeping track of them. We just do our best to make sure we are in touch with networks across the country, and regional networks try to update us. But those numbers are increasing every year exponentially, actually.
Sami, let's talk about the challenges that students are facing. Earlier this week, Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as Jewish Voice for Peace, released blistering reports on the ways in which Israel lobby groups on campuses are essentially doubling down on their efforts to silence, intimidate, slander, attack, and censor Palestine activism. And now these sorts of lobby groups are flush with a new injection of cash by billionaires such as Sheldon Adelson, the Republican Party mega donor, who are working with numerous anti-Palestinian groups to shut down campus activism on Palestine issues. What are students facing right now, and how is the national structure preparing to address it?
So while this report is, which is an excellent and thorough report, and we're happy that it's come out, is news, it's not really new. The things that it has inside of it, the things that it's representing and educating people about, it isn't news for us. We've been dealing with these issues from the very beginning, and we're not the first wave of student activism for Palestine that's been facing these issues. SJP isn't even the first organization to work on Palestine solidarity. This has been going on for decades in the United States. And these issues have been coming up, from the very beginning. I think, this recent news about the escalation of, campus repression, and also this news about Sheldon Adelson, injecting all this money to fight us, is actually good news for us. The reason I say that is because it means that we're effective. If a billionaire wants to spend, tens of millions of dollars fighting students who are doing the work they do on shoestring budgets, meeting in library rooms and dorm rooms, joking around while also doing organizing and enjoying the work they do because of how passionate they are, then he can do that. His fellow donors can also do that. It's not going to stop our work. Our work is not based off of any kind of economic force. Our work is fueled by the moral force of our work. The case for Palestine is actually easier to make than most people think. I think once the facts are laid out to people, if you approach it from a morally neutral standpoint, which is doesn't really exist, but if you come at it with a willingness to be open to new ideas, new facts, new knowledge, it's hard to come away with that new knowledge and not realize what's happening to the Palestinians is wrong, that their human rights are being violated, that the occupation needs to end, that the Palestinians have a right to return, and that Palestinian citizens in Israel should have equal rights like any other people in any other nation in the world. I think this is just affirmation for the work we're doing, actually, more than anything else.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
Intifada Electronica.
Intifada Electronica.
The Electronic Intifada.
We're speaking with Sami Suleiman. He is part of the national organizing structure of Students for Justice in Palestine. Sami, tell us about the national SJP conference coming up on October 9th and what the theme means to you as a student and as an organizer, this theme of connecting campuses to communities. What does that mean?
SJP's function on college campuses, we're a student organization, and the work we do has an effect on the campuses we work on, but the work we do also can have an effect on the communities in the communities we are part of. Each university is a part of a community, and it's easy to forget that sometimes. And we want to make sure we are open to that. We are open to the fact, and we are conscious of the fact that we are not just doing our work in the context of a campus, but within a community. And I think that is something we've become better at doing. For instance, recently in the Chicago and Midwest area, there's been a lot of activism, SJP activism and advocacy for Rasmiya Adeh and the trial she's been going through, which can only be called political repression. And students have rallied around her in the Midwest area for the past year or so, at least, And they've been very dedicated to that cause. I mean, examples of this also exist in New York. They exist in the Southwest with indigenous Latino communities. It exists in all the regions we are a part of. So it's a matter of grounding ourselves in that work, but also building community within ourselves. The national structure is meant to facilitate a community of student activists. I think one of the hard things about the work we do, as someone who has been doing this since about 2008, and having seen the changes that have come just even in that short amount of time, is that it can be very lonely work. It can be very lonely to do work that is perceived by most people as either radical or not mainstream, or in, you know, specifically to Palestine, just something that is not a popular cause. People, generally speaking, the tide is against us, and we're swimming against it, and that is very hard to do on a personal level, I think. And so when we build community, we're building communities in our locales, but we're building community amongst ourselves as well. And we're striving to create a structure that will be a home for us, somewhere where we can gather, open up to each other, expand our skills, expand our horizons, teach and learn from each other, and become a larger community across the country.
Finally, Sammy, what's your advice to students who are just getting their SJP chapter started and who are already facing intimidation by Israel-aligned organizations on campuses? And how can students get in touch with National SJP and get advice and guidance if they're going through that?
First thing I would say is get in touch with NSJP, get in touch with National Students for Justice Palestine. If you're in a particular region, try to reach out to your regional network. There are at least four regional SJP networks and some city networks that exist. They can contact us through our website. That was very easy to do. That's the first thing I would emphasize, because they need to know they're not alone. And that reflects what I think the importance of what I just said a minute ago. That is probably the hardest part of it, just starting. I actually helped start the SJP at Haverford College in my sophomore and junior year of college with my friend. It was just the two of us. There were only two of us for over a year until Operation Castelet happened and the massacre of Gazans happened. And that, I think, rallied a lot of people to our cause. But at first, it was just the only two Palestinians on our campus doing that work. It's very lonely. It's hard. It sucks. There's no other way of putting it. I hope that when they reach out to us, that reach out to their, you know, regions, their cities, if they are in a city, that they'll find a very welcoming, loving, supporting community of activists that are willing to help them ground themselves in the work they do, figure out how to deal with administration, and also encourage them, give them strength, personal strength. Because it requires personal endurance to do this kind of work and a willingness to face a lot of backfire. And that has to be expected. There's no, we can't lie about that. We can't tell people that you're not going to deal with great hardships. Otherwise, this work wouldn't be necessary. So reach out to us and let us give you a welcoming hand, and let us help you get your activism going on your campus and get this work started.
Again, the conference is October 9th to 11th at San Diego State University. Sammy, give us the website for National SJP and where people can find more information on the conference and the work in general that National SJP does.
Sure. They can find us at www.nationalsjp.org, and all this information is there.
Great. Sammy Suleiman, you're joining us from Brown University in Rhode Island. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast, and have a great conference.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses Russia's escalating military role in Syria's civil war. Marla Markham, who talks about the Climate Disobedience Center, which she co-founded, that serves as a catalyst for direct action and provides support for activists who engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue, who discusses her new report that links Operation Rescue and the group that released doctored videos to discredit Planned Parenthood. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after the Ebola outbreak killed over 11,000 people in West Africa, the health emergency was recently declared over in Sierra Leone, a hotspot of the epidemic. The last case involved an 8-month-old child who lived in a slum in the capital city of Freetown. The year-long Ebola epidemic left Sierra Leone's health system in shambles and raised major questions about the ability of the World Health Organization to prevent a new disease outbreak in the poor African nations of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. According to The Guardian, the regional office for WHO operations in West Africa failed to contain Ebola by pressing national health ministries into action. It took months for WHO to diagnose the first case of Ebola in Guinea, and as Ebola spread to neighboring countries, WHO failed to declare a full-scale health emergency. In early August 2014, WHO Director Margaret Chan finally acted when confronted by Doctors Without Borders President Joanne Liu. Barbara Stocking, a former president of Oxfam, led an independent investigation of WHO's Ebola response, which concluded that the health agency's top executives lacked courageous decision-making and failed to communicate effectively with field staff. Under pressure from public health advocates, WHO Director Chan has promised to create a new system for future health emergencies by building a global network of emergency volunteers who could respond within hours to the next health crisis. As a teenager in Pittsford, Vermont, David Blittersdorf built his first wind turbine. Today, he runs his own wind power company that delivers clean, renewable energy to more than 4,000 homes. Today, 100% of the power used in Vermont's largest city, Burlington, comes from renewable sources. Vermont is also the only state in the continental United States to be exempted from President Obama's Clean Power Plan, since the Green Mountain State has already surpassed the program's goal of 45% of its power coming from renewable sources. Rob Sargent, who runs the energy program for Environment America, told the Christian Science Monitor Vermont is a model for the biggest thing that needs to be done, to set aggressive goals and get people to link arms and achieve them. Back in the 1970s, Burlington's electric department relied on an old, dirty coal power plant. Instead of building a new coal plant, the city invested in a biomass plant that burned wood chips, a local natural resource. Now the city's current biomass plant is the largest electric producer in the state. Today the plant generates 45% of the city's electricity and is a net-zero carbon emitter. Vermonters have taken steps that could show the way for other states, from how it sells clean power to neighboring polluters to how it changed the way its power grid is run. Under pressure from the Republican Congress to balance its books, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, which runs the Federal Housing Administration, has, since 2010, been packaging thousands of non-performing home mortgages and selling them to private investors at a huge discount. Housing advocates maintain HUD, which is tasked with creating strong communities and affordable housing, is instead facilitating a massive transfer of wealth from working families to wealthy hedge fund investors under the Distressed Assets Stabilization Program. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who together with HUD directly or indirectly insure 70% of the country's mortgages, began similar sales this summer. The Center for Public Integrity concluded that thus far the program has failed to prevent most homeowners from being driven into foreclosure. A quarterly report on the program from 2014 found only 11% of homeowners whose mortgages were sold in the federal program were still making mortgage payments. Diane Cipollone, a consultant with the National Fair Housing Alliance, observed, "The investors are out to make money. They are not there to do neighborhood revitalization or neighborhood stabilization." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The brutal civil war in Syria has thus far claimed the lives of an estimated 250,000 people while creating millions of internal and external refugees seeking safe haven from the conflict in the Middle East and across Europe. After 4.5 years of war, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whose regime has been condemned for its indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, has in recent months lost ground to both Western-backed opposition rebel groups and ISIS. Russia, a longtime ally of Syria, has now joined the conflict with the goal of bolstering Assad's weakened military. Russian airstrikes carried out by sophisticated fighter jets, along with the deployment of tanks and armored personnel carriers, has been criticized by the U.S. and NATO for supporting a regime whose ruthless tactics, they say, triggered the armed rebellion in 2011. They further charge that Russia has not targeted ISIS, but Western-backed rebel groups. Russian officials have rejected the charge and maintain that their targets are ISIS, al-Nusra, and other terrorist groups. Conflicting reports on the future deployment of Russian ground troops into Syria and their warplanes' recent violation of Turkish airspace has ratcheted up tensions. Your reporter spoke with Chris Tensing, executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of their publication Middle East Report. Here he assesses the possible consequences of Russia's escalating military role in Syria's civil war and prospects for a negotiated end to the conflict.
External intervention almost always just prolongs the conflict because it increases the belief of the proxy combatants in the civil war itself that they can prevail. It increases their confidence that they can win. And I think that is still what's happening here. Certainly the narrative was. Syrian regime was on the ropes. Even Hezbollah was starting to desert it, that it was having real problems recruiting people to fight on the battlefield, and that by default, the insurgency, various insurgencies were gaining ground. And so therefore, the Russian intervention has basically not only strengthened the regime militarily, but also stiffened its resolve. And so I think unless this is a break from the pattern, which I don't see why it would be yet. The response, we've already seen it from the U.S., and it's coming from the Saudis too, the response will be escalation on the part of the outside powers that back the insurgencies against the Assad regime, and it'll strengthen the same logic there. And so, again, there are no good guys, and the victims are the Syrian people who have to somehow survive as various foes of theirs, foreign and domestic, act out their own agendas on Syrian land.
What, if any, common ground exists between Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, the United States, and the NATO countries when it comes to Syria that could lay the groundwork for some future negotiations that could end this conflict?
Well, as one of my colleagues, Daryl Lee, put it, the problem with Syria and with Iraq too, the territory that is controlled by the so-called Islamic State. The problem is that everyone hates ISIS, but everyone fears something else more. So their fear of something else is greater than their hatred of ISIS. And that's why they're not willing to do what it takes, quote unquote, to remove the threat of ISIS. With Turkey, that's the Kurds. You know, you could run down the list of actors and come up with the thing that they are more concerned about than they are about ISIS itself. So the diplomatic challenge, if we could imagine a supranational body, I don't know, the UN maybe, that sincerely had not only this mandate but also this intent to find this diplomatic common ground, the game would be to convince the various external and domestic actors, you know, so also the Assad regime and the other components of the Syrian opposition, both armed and unarmed, that their fear of ISIS ought to be their number one priority and that these other things are secondary. Again, history is just not terribly encouraging with respect to that agenda. It's tremendously difficult. The war, not just in Syria, but the war in Yemen too, wars across the region, the situation in Libya, all of these pose incredibly thorny and complex challenges to not just the left, but to anybody who is really concerned about international peace and security and about the future of the people in the region. These questions are not easy, and if we pretend they are, we're not doing anybody any favors.
One of the factors in this conflict in Syria is the Sunni-Shia divide, and members of the Alawite minority in Syria, many of them are convinced that there will be mass slaughter if Bashar al-Assad should leave power, and they believe that all that stands between them and death and genocide is this horrible regime. But what are some of your thoughts about how that bridge can be crossed if there is to be a negotiated settlement?
Well, what you said about the Alawites is exactly right, and it is pretty much the core explanation for why the regime has survived throughout all of these nine circles of hell. And the fear that you mentioned is not irrational. There have been numerous documented cases of sectarian massacres of Alawis, of Christians, of Sunni Muslims, of pretty much everyone, Kurds as well. How does one address it? Well, Syrians themselves are largely addressing it with their feet. They're leaving the country en masse and have been for years. But there is goodwill that does still exist. There are still many, many Syrians who have not just an anti-sectarian vision for their country, but a non-sectarian vision for their country, a pluralistic one. That is to say that it's not just that they reject sectarian rhetoric and sectarian thinking, but that they actively have a proactive and positive agenda for transcending that kind of discourse and that kind of practice in the future. Those people are the hope of the country. And the question is how to empower them. And before they get empowered, they have to be made part of the political equation again in a way that they were in the early days of the uprising. They were the most important part of the equation in the early days of the uprising in 2011. And the regime robbed them of that on purpose by reacting with such disproportionate, vicious force is the word to use. The only way to return those Syrians who are the solution, ultimately, to their own country's problem is to end the fighting as soon as possible and with a minimum of additional damage to Syria, the country, and Syria, the people.
That was Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report. Find more news and analysis of recent events in Syria by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Four activists who have carried out creative acts of nonviolent direct action have banded together to form a new organization called the Climate Disobedience Center. Acting from their deeply held faith perspectives, these four individuals, Tim DeChristopher, Jay O'Hara, Ken Ward, and Marla Markham, are launching the center to inspire activists to take similar risks for climate justice and generate support for those who do. That would include pursuit of a necessity defense in court, in which activists charged with a violation of the law claim their actions were necessary to prevent a greater harm, like runaway climate change. Tim DeChristopher served 21 months in prison after being convicted of fraudulently bidding on gas and oil leases offered in Utah at the end of the George W. Bush administration. Even though the auction for those parcels was declared illegal by the incoming Obama administration, Obama's Justice Department still chose to prosecute DeChristopher. O'Hara and Ward piloted a lobster boat to block a 40,000-ton coal shipment to a Massachusetts power plant in 2013 and faced trial the following year. Markham is a longtime climate activist who has organized a number of protest actions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marla Markham during a recent New England climate activist organizers retreat. Here she explains the rationale for their new group and what they hope to accomplish.
One thing that happened over the course of working together, and especially seeing through Ken and Jay's action to trial, was a recognition that if we do our actions in ways that don't demonize people, but really focus on trying to shift systems and recognizing that we're all stuck in the same system and trying to give people an opportunity to use whatever power they have to access the movement, then we can bring new people into the work. So for example, on the day of Ken and Jay's trial in Fall River, Massachusetts, we had turned out about 140 supporters, roughly 47 of them clergy wearing their collars. And we had a lot of contingency plans for the day. We didn't know what would happen. In fact, we had bought another boat, and there was a boat parked moored down at the pier, ready to go. We assumed that the DA was going to drop the charges that day, and we were then going to pay whatever fines and go get in the boat and do it again. So we had a plan for that. We had a plan for if we went all the way through the trial and they were convicted and taken straight to jail, which was unlikely, but we had a plan for that. The only thing we didn't plan for was the DA being on our side. And that's the thing that happened. So we began to recognize when we thought about it afterward that what we had done was given him an opportunity to use the power that he has to be part of making some change in the movement. Normally, he doesn't have any access with his institutional power to the movement at all. And when we put him in a position where he had to think about what he was going to do and what was right and wrong and what he could do from his position, he made a choice that we had forgotten to expect of our elected leaders. So I like to say that one of the gifts that Sam Sutter gave to us as the district attorney of Bristol County was that he reminded us that we need to ask more of our elected leaders. We had forgotten to ask them to lead. We had forgotten to even expect that they might think to do it. And so we decided that we wanted to keep working together to try to support people to take actions that really give more and more people an opportunity to make a choice. So we're trying to support actions that create moral tension that's really public and really simple and that we see all the way through to trial so that we can use necessity defense.
Just say a little bit more about what the DA actually said and what he did right after he dropped the charges.
So when Sam Sutter started talking, he said something like climate change is the most pressing threat of our time or something. And he went on to say that the decision that he had made to drop the charges and, you know, ask us to pay for the time spent by the overtime spent by the police was taken with the taxpayers of Bristol County in mind, but also with the future of their children and their children's children in mind. And then he went on to say that he was going to march with us in the People's Climate March in about 2 weeks later. And he did. He marched pretty much the whole People's Climate March with us.
That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. He brought his staff and his family with him. And then another extraordinary thing that happened is that the mayor of Fall River was recalled shortly after that. And Sam decided to run for mayor, and he's now the mayor of Fall River.
The name is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Climate Disobedience Center. How did you come up with that? And explain how that fits into what you explained is the goal of the organization.
Yeah, so we really want to be building a culture of resistance, because the powers that keep us stuck in the systems that we're all stuck in aren't going to change because it's the right thing to do. They're only going to change with the application of some real resistance and power from regular folks like us. And we have to build a culture of resistance. And so we were talking about wanting to prioritize supporting civil disobedience actions, and we just got to the, and we know we want to focus on climate, so we just landed on climate disobedience as a phrase, and decided that we would be the Climate Disobedience Center. And we think it's really important for people who want to take higher legal risk actions and see them through to trial and really risk, perhaps, as Tim did, prison time for their cause, that we think it's really important for those people to have the resources to support that effort, to be able to have folks who help them build a support team around them, to have folks who help their lawyers understand the necessity defense and how these folks want their cases to be part of a movement action. And they don't just want to get off as quickly as they can. They actually want to use it as part of their action. So we hope to help build support teams, help people prepare sort of emotionally and spiritually for the long work of uncertainty that comes with putting yourself in that position, and to make sure that they have people around them who bring in more and more people to support them.
That was Marla Markham, a co-founder of the new Climate Disobedience Center. For more information on the center and its mission, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The latest flashpoint for a Republican-led threat to shut down the U.S. federal government is centered around the GOP and its anti-abortion allies campaign to defund Planned Parenthood. A government shutdown was averted when a stopgap funding bill was signed by President Obama on September 30th, but that only postpones the threat of a shutdown until December 11th, when the temporary funding bill expires. The effort to deny Planned Parenthood federal funds began last summer, when a group called the Center for Medical Progress released a series of covertly made videos that accused Planned Parenthood staff of harvesting aborted human body parts and illegally selling fetal tissue to medical researchers for profit. Allegations of illegal conduct featured in the deceptively edited videos, as well as statements from David Dalidon, founder of the Center for Medical Progress, have been widely debunked. Following the release of the videos, six states launched investigations into Planned Parenthood's activities and cleared the organization of any wrongdoing. Your reporter spoke with People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue, who discusses her new report titled Operation Rescue's Big Break, how an organization rooted in the radical fringes of the anti-choice movement is threatening to shut down the government.
This summer, a group called the Center for Medical Progress began releasing a series of videos from an undercover operation that had set up a fake medical company to infiltrate Planned Parenthood. And they claimed that these videos show that Planned Parenthood was violating federal laws about donating fetal tissue for medical research. And those claims have been pretty well debunked. A number of six states have now closed investigations and found no wrongdoing.
The accusation that Planned Parenthood is selling fetal tissue for research and making a profit at it has been debunked. But maybe you could explain the accusations being made a little bit more and where the truth lies and how we know that the truth is not on the side of the accusers here.
Right. So in 1993, Congress passed a law that allowed the use of fetal tissue that comes from elective abortions to be used for medical research. And this has been used for a lot of research on diseases including Parkinson's. It's sometimes used for vaccine development. And that's a separate ethical debate, whether fetal tissue research should be legal. And I think that's a legitimate ethical debate, but that's not the debate that these folks are trying to have. It's interesting that since this law was passed in 1993, a number of anti-abortion groups have tried to use the fetal tissue research as a wedge issue to get at abortion providers, and especially at Planned Parenthood. what the law says is that you can't profit from the sale of fetal tissue. So you can charge for the expenses that it takes to get it to someone, but you can't profit off of it. And it's pretty clear from the videos that the Center for Medical Progress has released that that isn't actually what was happening at Planned Parenthood. They edited out a bunch of instances of Planned Parenthood officials very explicitly saying that they weren't profiting from this. So this is a option that is given to women at a very small number of Planned Parenthood clinics to voluntarily donate fetal tissue, and that they don't profit off it. They abide by federal law. But this is something that I think anti-abortion groups have seen as a possible wedge issue for a long time. In 1999, a group called Life Dynamics in Texas, which is where the Center for Medical Progress says that they got the idea for their Planned Parenthood smear, tried to do something very similar with abortion clinics in Texas, and that investigation fell apart when the mole that they had placed in a medical procurement company admitted before Congress that he had made up parts of his story. And then in 2008, Operation Rescue, which is a big group behind the Center for Medical Progress, tried to get a Planned Parenthood clinic outside of Kansas City investigated for fetal tissue donation violations, and that was baseless as well.
Well, just a final question here for you, and this is probably an important issue at the root of all this, and that is, What do we know about public opinion on Planned Parenthood and its receiving federal fund? Do we know whether or not this controversy and these many false accusations that have been issued by these groups and by politicians have made any dent in support for Planned Parenthood and its mission?
Well, about a week ago, a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll showed that the public support for Planned Parenthood had actually remained steady throughout this whole thing, that about 60% of Americans still support having federal funding for Planned Parenthood, which is important to note. Federal funding does not go to abortions through Planned Parenthood. This is Medicaid reimbursements for women's health care. And actually, one thing that the poll found was that Planned Parenthood at this point has more support than the Republican Party. So it's still, I think that people understand what Planned Parenthood does and what it does not. And especially, you know, women who have taken advantage of the services that Planned Parenthood offers. I know that I'm one of them. And I think it's hard to convince people who have gotten medical care from Planned Parenthood that it's actually secretly an evil organization, which is what they're trying to do. And I think that people kind of see through the goal of these videos, and people appreciate Planned Parenthood for what it does.
That was People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue. Find links to Miranda's report on Operation Rescue, the Center for Medical Progress, and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. Someone wrote to me and asked my opinion about, quote, shadow governments, unquote, and what I think the solution is. This term, quote, shadow government, unquote, is used to describe those agencies within a government whose existence is kept secret from the public, or whose activities are kept secret. It also includes those private entities to whom secret activities are now outsourced, those so-called private contractors doing the government's dirty work. I suppose this idea of shadow governments becomes more and more of a concern to people as they come to realize just how much of the proverbial iceberg is below the surface. The depth and scope of the domestic spying, the vast array of alphabet soup agencies creeping around, unaccountable, taking liberties with our liberties. This is not the government system as advertised in your 1950s civics textbooks, that's for sure. But look, we can't view shadow governments as something separate and distinct from the rest of government. Despite the perception of shadow government as a distinct rogue operation totally divorced from the above-ground, democratically elected, and fully accountable, benevolent government, shadow governments do not exist in that kind of vacuum. Anywhere that you have private contractors spying on American cell phone communications, somebody has appropriated funds for their desks and their pencils, their coffee pots and their toilet seats. Everywhere that you've got a paramilitary whack job in a ski mask lurking in black sites and waterboarding brown people, somebody has appropriated funds for the guards and the rifles, the shackles and the break room vending machines. So, however secret squirrel any operation is, you can trace the toilet paper and the toner cartridges back to bank accounts set up by middle managers with proper authorization, whatever that means. And you can justify those accounts' legality by reading the right authorization bill passed by Congress. My point is, the inception of all the secret squirrel shadow government shenanigans isn't really happening in the shadows at all. Turn on C-SPAN, and you can watch it all happen. Live. Right now. No kidding. My point is, we cannot think of shadow governments as some separate evil thing operating apart from our wonderful, responsive, kumbaya government. It's not. It's the flip side of the same coin. Currently, the shadow operators conduct grisly business secretly so that their non-shadow counterparts don't have to directly get their hands dirty. But if we came up with some way to disband all shadow government stuff, if we could click the heels of our ruby slippers and make all of that nastiness go away, we'd only change the world for one day. Tops. If we rid the world of shadow government operations today and made the world safe for mom, apple pie, and the American way, whatever that is, we'd turn on C-SPAN tomorrow to find a new flurry of activities to immediately create new government agencies and to shovel millions of our dollars into them. Plain and simple, when you're in the omelet business, you gotta find somebody to crack the eggs. And those egg crackers don't come cheap. Newsflash, the United States government is in the omelet business. And we're all eggs. So there's only one way to do away with shadow government, and that's to get rid of the portion of government in the light that casts the shadow in the first place. It all has to go, because it's all part of the larger complex that functions together. Even the most responsive, limited, accountable government, in the maintenance of its own power and authority, will eventually and inevitably end up with redacted documents in secret files, computer databases filled with information not shared with the folks who paid for the software. Where there's government, there's shadow government. And where there's shadow government, There's a vast population of slaves, monitored, surveilled, controlled, and exploited, held at gunpoint by those who strive to manipulate what everyone knows and, as a consequence, what everyone thinks and does. Freedom demands that we burn the entirety of the master's house, not just half of it. These are the words of anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, held incommunicado on orders of Ohio prison officials, whose addresses are posted on blastblog.noblogs.org. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Even as efforts continue at Fiat Chrysler to reach an agreement rank-and-file auto workers can accept, the United Auto Workers Union is preparing for a strike that could start at 11:59 p.m. Wednesday night. Let there be no doubt that rank-and-file auto workers are ready to fight and to sacrifice in solidarity for fair labor contracts at the Detroit 3 automakers. Chad Johnson is in Local 2015.
A fair day's pay for a fair day's work, equal pay for equal work for every member must be at the forefront of any collective bargaining conversation. We must secure economic and social gains for our brothers and sisters. We must bring the bottom up as we are our brothers and sisters' keepers.
Donnie Jones is president of UAW Local 977.
As a third-generation auto worker, I am mindful of the earlier sacrifices of our brothers and sisters that made the gains both at the bargaining table and at the picket lines that we so dearly enjoy today. By building upon this groundbreaking work, we have the privilege, honor, and responsibility to continue to collectively bargain for both us and for the next generation.
Mark Monroe is a member of UAW Local 167.
My plant is about 98% two-tier. We've done our time. I think it's time that we all come up together. GM's making billions of dollars, and I think we need to enjoy those fruits as we make the product.
Matt Beaver is in UAW Local 699.
We go back in history, look at 1937, a 44-day sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan. They got a one-page contract. Look how much our forefathers and everybody here built your language you have today in contracts because you have a voice in the workplace.
Wince Valentine III is a UAW delegate who attended the March convention in Detroit. He says that two-tier workers deserve a better deal.
I represent two-tier workers who cannot buy the vehicles that we proudly make. We must bridge the gap in our pay and working conditions and secure an American dream for all.
Pat Wallace of UAW Local 1250 urged solidarity in the ranks as the union rises to meet this latest challenge.
Our pride and dignity are at stake. The world is watching us. It is very important that we do stand together as one and united in this great United Auto Workers.
The first ever poll of U.S. workers making less than $15 an hour shows 72% support for unions. The National Law Employment Project says 42% of American workers make less than $15 an hour. Its poll released this week shows 69% of low-wage workers who are not registered to vote would register to vote for a candidate who supports a $15 an hour minimum wage and policies making it easier to join unions. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. With a strike at Fiat Chrysler having been averted, UAW workers will soon be voting on that second tentative agreement. UAW leaders say significant gains were made in the second round of bargaining. The union's bargaining committee voted to send the proposed contract to local UAW leaders and their Chrysler Council. The UAW Chrysler Council will meet Friday in Detroit to review and vote on the tentative agreement. If they approve, the UAW plans to make details of the new agreement public immediately. Then it still must be ratified by rank-and-file UAW workers at Fiat Chrysler. UAW President Dennis Williams says leadership heard the members and went back to the table at Fiat Chrysler to strengthen the new labor agreement. Williams says he believes this new tentative agreement addresses UAW members' principal concerns about their jobs and their futures. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Mark Pocan this week introduced the Workplace Democracy Act. Senator Sanders says it would greatly strengthen the rights of American workers to join unions.
This legislation will make it easier for workers to join unions and collectively bargain for higher wages and stronger benefits. Under this legislation, when a majority of workers in a bargaining unit sign valid authorization cards to join a union, they will have a union. End of discussion.
United Food and Commercial Workers President Mark Perrone says talk at the White House Worker Voice Summit won't be enough. Perrone says action must be taken. Action, he says, to stop, quote, irresponsible employers that cut wages and benefits, misclassify workers as independent contractors or hire temporary workers to avoid responsibilities as an employer, and punish those who speak out and try to better their lives, end quote. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says Hillary Clinton's opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement has proven again that she is a champion for working people. The AFT endorsed Clinton for president in July. Weingarten says the TPP threatens to harm workers and the environment. While most Americans still struggle to get ahead, Weingarten says, trade agreements like the TPP only make their situation worse.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News, made possible in part through underwriting support from the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union, and from the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
What are Canada's foreign policy aims in taking such a hard line against Iran? Why has Russia joined the fight against the Islamic State in Syria? And how is their involvement affecting U.S.-NATO ambitions? how successful were economic sanctions in forcing the hand of the Iranian state? What strategies have been used against Iran in the past, and how likely is a war with Iran in the future? How does the Iranian nuclear deal serve as a weapon against Russia? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we set our sights on some of the recent maneuvers by the West in and around Iran and Syria. We'll be speaking to senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne, Binoy Kampmark, about the Canadian government's ambitions with regard to the developments in Syria and Iran. Then award-winning author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Darius Nazemroya joins us to share his perspective on the real motivations behind the recently signed Iranian nuclear deal and how it is expected to impact countries like Russia. On this week's program, Canadian and American subterfuge in Syria and Iran, conversations with Binoy Kampmark and Mahdi Nazemroya. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 9th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is anything but selective about the head-chopping, culture-erasing monsters besieging Syria, CIA-trained or not, stating last week, quote, "If it looks like a terrorist, if it acts like a terrorist, if it walks like a terrorist, if it fights like a terrorist, it's a terrorist, right?" The U.S. and U.K., of course, are both bombing and supporting insurgents entirely illegally in Syria, having no UN mandate and no request from the country's governing body. Vladimir Putin had said, quote, "We have an invitation and we intend to fight against terrorist organizations and them only," unquote, possibly referring to allegations that the U.S. has been targeting Syrian government sites and military personnel. That comes from the article, "Syria, Russian Intervention Exposes Coalition Lies. The Terrorists Are Us," by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted October 7th. The Russian Air Force has been pounding terrorist targets across the Idlib governorate for the last few days, as well as ISIS strongholds in the east at Rafah. On Sunday, according to a report filed by South Front, roughly 700 militants surrendered to members of the 147th Syrian Tank Brigade shortly after bombers had attacked nearby cities of Mardej, Maharat al-Numan, Jisr al-Shukur, Sarakib, and Samin. Russian bombers will soften targets on the front lines, ground troops will move into position, and untold numbers of jihadis will either flee, surrender, or get cut down where they stand. Bottom line, Syria is not going to be a quagmire as the media has predicted. To the contrary, Putin is going to cut through these guys like crap through a goose. That comes from the article, "How Putin Will Win in Syria," by Mike Whitney, posted October 7th, originally appearing in Counterpunch. In a Financial Times op-ed, former Carter administration national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski irresponsibly said Russia, quote, "launched air attacks at Syrian elements that are sponsored, trained, and equipped by the Americans, inflicting damage and causing casualties," unquote. Washington has, quote unquote, "only one real option," he claimed, "to protect its regional interests," quote, "to convey to Moscow the demand that it cease and desist from military actions that directly affect American assets," unquote. He stopped short of explaining their ISIS and other imported terrorists, not moderate Syrian opponents, one of many big lies about Obama's war, systematically destroying another country. Instead of applauding his righteous efforts, Brzezinski urged, quote-unquote, prompt U.S. retaliation? Is he suggesting possible nuclear war? That comes from the article, Dangerous Crossroads, Lunatics in Washington Want Direct Military Confrontation with Russia, by Stephen Lendman, posted October 7th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Last July, world powers arrived at a deal to lift international sanctions on Iran in return for curbing its nuclear program. Canada, however, appears to be offside with traditional partners like the US, UK, and France, and are maintaining their sanctions and their hard, hostile line against Iran. To help contextualize Canada's foreign policy stances in light of the nuclear deal and the current aggression being waged in Syria, we are joined by Binoy Campmark. He was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge, and currently serves as Senior Lecturer in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. A frequent contributor to the Global Research website, he joined us in the CKUW studio in early October. Is there anything that you've noticed that concerns you specifically about the way Canada has been conducting itself on the world stage?
Yes, I think one of the things that is very conspicuous is the, you know, that remarkably hawkish warring agenda which Harper has embraced, and where that fits. Effectively, it works on a few levels. It's a kind of a demonization that is functioning on the policy platform, and so it's the idea of seeing it's the Islamist debate. Of course, it's the idea of how do you combat Islamic state and so forth. And what is happening in the conduct of that foreign policy is that it's had a dramatic impact on domestic policy. And that is, of course, C-24, I believe, you know, the stripping of citizenship, you know, and that's dramatic. That's a remarkable instance. It's not as dramatic as the British approach to this, which allows for the prospect of stripping British citizenship and making a person stateless, which is actually contrary to international law. C-24 does allow, at least, for dual nationals to retain one nationality, but the implication of that in having Canadian citizenship stripped is that that person may well be deported, that person may well be expelled, and, of course, the recipient country will then receive a convict of terrorism. And so effectively that results in an export of terrorism in a peculiar kind of way. Harper has created a sort of an industry, anticipating an industry of sorts. And this undermining of citizenship has translated itself, broadly speaking, because of this emphasis, this mania about expanding the war on Islamic State. I'm not suggesting for a minute that Islamic State doesn't pose a threat in the region. But the Canadian indifference, this is Harper's indifference to understanding the implications of an expanded bombing campaign, ineffectual, I might add. You know, this is one of the most bizarre things. It's, you know, ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, they're all actually doing rather well. Their economy and their base is being sustained constantly, notwithstanding the fact that they are being bombed. And so there is this display of power, which is not actually very effectual at all, but it has very significant impacts on domestic legislation, on the security state, and the implications, certainly under Harper's time, are significant for the emergence of a considerably heavily involved surveillance state that has that views its citizens actually with suspicion, at least its citizens, except, of course, good Canadian stock and so forth.
Mm. Now, there's also, in addition to the war against ISIS, you also have countries Syria and Iran, which are seen as enemies, the governments therein. And, of course, recently we've heard about how Russia has come to join the fight against ISIS, and that seems to be – their approach seems to be – turning the leaders of that, the U.S. NATO folks off. And
Yes, they've certainly introduced a sizable spanner in the works, and what they've done, of course, is and let's not fall for the general idea that the Russian approach here is not to target Islamic State necessarily. I know there are numerous media reports coming in suggesting that these particular positions are actually at FSA, Free Syria Army units that supposedly the Russian Air Force is targeting. But as Robert Fisk pointed out very recently, it's a very peculiar thing to say that, in Homs, for example, the area of Homs, that there were actually FSA units, because supposedly, according to the U.S. own debriefing from the State Department, those CIA-trained units were not there. They were disbanded in that particular area. So obviously, it was a bit peculiar to then suggest that they are there now, suddenly, renascent. So that's one problem in this war of words and information. Again, we come back to the old story. What is it that we need to look at? What is it we need to read and engage in? But the second thing, too, of course, is that they have fundamentally different objectives on a certain level. Now, Russia is interested in controlling the Islamic threat because it has the Chechenian issue. Of course, remember, if you look geographically at the Russian context, Chechnya is south. It's not the Middle East. It's the southern east, it's the south, if you were. So relative to that quaint term, the Middle East to Western powers, the Russian context views it differently. Geographically speaking, Iran and the Arab states are focused in a very different league, a very different aspect of their strategy. But Chechnya looms large, and they have been Chechen recruits for ISIS. Mm. There have been Chechen participants, and a very notable Chechen leader has certainly figured in Islamic State. So that's that aspect to consider. But the other, of course, problem here from the NATO and the U.S. perspective is that the policy is, of course, also to shore up Assad. It's to give him better legroom in terms of the conflict. Whereas the U.S.-led approach with France, with Britain, has always made it clear that they want Assad to be removed. And Russia has made it clear that, no, Assad is doing a lot of the fighting, his forces are doing a lot of the fighting, and we need to bolster his efforts. And this is where, again, you can see the worldviews collide. You can see that they're very fundamentally different views about this. The U.S. are using that fabulously concocted notion of liberalism and liberal markets to tell and suggest that the Syrian leader, Bashar al-Assad, brutal, yes, admittedly, that he has to go, but they have come up with this nonsense term called transitional government. And we know what transitional governments look like. They look like Libya. They look like Libya after Gaddafi. They look like Iraq after Saddam Hussein. So expect another instance of a repeat in Syria if that particular envisaged plan takes place, and that's what the Russians want to avoid.
Yeah. Now, you just brought up Libya, and I think it's kind of important because I know that you wrote a paper about Libya or contributed a paper on Libya about 2 years ago, and your appraisal of that whole – it was – framed as a humanitarian intervention to protect the people from this brutal dictator. And I guess what was the Syria, I suppose, would have been the, just the taking that same approach to protect the people of Syria. And it doesn't seem to be working too well. But if you could talk about how that intervention in Syria has helped shape the not only the dialogue but the reality that's on display given the current confrontation with Syria.
Well, yes, the whole concept of protecting the people is used all too conveniently, and it's used to distinguish, for example, French, UK, US efforts and a part of that coalition. As opposed to Assad, he's always mentioned as using barrel bombs, and there's been, of course, the case of chemical weapons and a range of other weapons used. But the reality is that there's so many sides in this conflict. So many sides have a stake in the Syrian conflict, because it's in a sense at the front line of a series of global events writ large, where you've got the role of Iran and Hezbollah, you've got the role of Russia and its interest, and you've got the U.S. Side of the equation and how it sees stability or instability in this particular case, and trying to maintain leverage and influence over a country that's also deemed an enemy of Israel, So you've got a range of strategic factors that play into that, and the people are just the chess pieces, you know, of the scriptwriter. And yes, all sides are using the rhetoric of civilian deaths and using this in degree of protection. It's obvious that Assad is not particularly interested in protecting certain number of Syrians. The brutality of his armed forces is renowned, but by the same token, you can't exactly find sainted angels in the FSA, the Free Syria Army. The notion of a moderate Syrian opposition is of course, quite absurd. How can one be moderate, armed, heavily armed to the teeth, and happy to also conduct one's own little cleansing campaigns? And added to that, of course, are different groupings with different.
Like al-Nusra?
Yes, exactly. Al-Nusra with and even al-Nusra has disagreements at times with al-Qaeda and so forth. And so you've got an al-Qaeda grouping, you've got an al-Nusra grouping, and you've got the associated peculiarities of ISIL and so forth. So what we have, essentially, are a range of groups that are promoting their agendas on Syrian soil. And the Syrian people are, of course, the ones to suffer from it. And occasionally they're idealized in UN resolutions, or they might be idealized in the context of humanitarian intervention. But you can't have, as I have mentioned before, you can't have humanitarian intervention at the end of a Tomahawk missile. It just does not work like that. Humanitarian intervention is grotesquely euphemistic, because it suggests a constructive notion when it's actually, at the end of the day, a warring destructive notion, which we pad around, essentially. And responsibility to protect, I'm very critical of the doctrine, even though I know it's very much, the flavor in the human securities movement, and very much, has been the flavor of international, at least attempts to discuss international law reforms. But the reality of it is that it's so often a cloak, a garb, a veil to justify realpolitik and genuine power interventions.
Just doing an end run against around the principle of sovereignty of nations.
Yes, exactly. Well, what it does is essentially it attacks sovereignty via the back door, and it just cloaks it under a different term.
Yeah, and it's telling the countries that are pushing for that. I mean, Russia has been against that. They're trying to support that principle of sovereignty of nations. And
yes, and of course, and again, I do understand that this is diplomacy is a feast of hypocrisies, and I do understand that it can be perceived that the Russian approach has not been particularly noble regarding Ukraine and notions of sovereignty there. But the principle still remains that critics of humanitarian intervention, have a point in calling it. For example, Bricbon calls it, a form of imperialism, humanitarian imperialism, because ultimately humanity is used as a trick, as a plague. And in that particular case, it ends up with disastrous consequences, because the very people who are meant to be protected end up being injured, as we saw in cases like Libya, which is essentially being run now by a set of, fiefdoms of various groupings and religious affiliations.
Mm. I noticed that there was a nuclear deal that was struck, and there's been some contention in the United States, but the president is essentially promoting this in principle. And interestingly enough, Canada has been particularly critical of Iran. They've been very guarded about the whole nuclear issue with Iran. What, in your view, guides Canada's approach to Iran? I mean, they talk about it being a supporter of terrorism, but is that it, or is there a little something?
I think it has to do with the Obviously. Well, I say it's obvious because it seems to certainly conform to a pattern that I've seen in the context of a good number of members of Congress, certainly the GOP, and also in other countries where any country that are willing to listen to Netanyahu, you know, the Israeli prime minister, you know, who is the one spreading the line that such an agreement is dangerous, that you cannot have an agreement with Iran, because it follows from the premise that because it is terrorist, you cannot negotiate with them. And this, of course, is one of those self-defeating illusory measures that means that you don't negotiate with anybody that you can just label a terrorist. Iran has, of course, been, you know, preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon is the primary concern. But it's the primary concern for the countries involved with the agreement to begin with. Even though I've always felt that this is a very dangerous process, I always thought it was deeply hypocritical for powers to get together, especially those who have it. And that's the problem with the, of course, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has been argued, may have prevented more countries from going nuclear. That may be true. But at its core is a principle of bribery, because the NPT is based on the principle that the countries who have nuclear weapons, well, we will eventually disband them, but not for now. And the countries who don't have nuclear weapons, well, you shouldn't have, and you don't have nuclear weapons, and you'll be in violation if you have nuclear weapons. But we will give you a concession. You can have cheap nuclear energy. So that was the trade-off. Now, the trade-off has been totally, you know, misplaced, at least historically, with Iran, and Iran was trying to play on that. So quite legitimately in the context of that. But the reality of it is that it's become so, or it's almost like a hysterical idea that if Iran gets the weapon, it will destabilize the region. There is a certain amount of truth in that. It's not even Israel itself, which could be, I mean, Israel would be a significant problem, having taken the stance that Iran is not going to be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. But the Saudis have also made it clear that in the event that Iran gets a nuclear weapon, and this is something the Israelis play on, I want to add that the Israelis and the Saudis on this actually do see eye to eye, which is one of those curiosities that maybe your listeners may or may not be familiar with. The secret services of respective countries do have ties when it comes to dealing with Iran. And of course, Saudi Arabia is the great enemy of Iran. Historically, of course, the Sunni-Shia divide is made very bleak there, where you've got the Shiites represented by Iran, fundamentally so, and of course the Sunnis in the form of Saudi Arabia, and there you see that replayed in Syria as well. So the Saudis have also made it clear. In fact, there were some rumors that went around last year that in the event that Iran was to obtain a nuclear weapon, they would try to seek Pakistani help in obtaining a Pakistani nuclear option. So the nuclear weapons would be run by the Pakistanis, but essentially they would be placed on Saudi soil. So that was one of the rumors that were not entirely scotched, I think, to my satisfaction. So with all that said, and how does that come back and relate to the Canadian role? The Canadian role, I would say, is linked to that by virtue of swallowing the Netanyahu line of security. And certainly the U.S. line, not necessarily from Obama, but certainly from the GOP line, that particular line, has been swallowed by Harper on this. And he's almost wanting to make us, you know, again, it's one of those things where smaller states, you know, want to sound louder and bigger than they are. So he wants to make the impression that this is a fundamental point, to take the, you know, lead against terrorism. But this is, of course, a childish approach, because you cannot have a security resolution in Syria without Iran, and you cannot have a peaceful resolution in the Middle East of any of the crises happening there without Iran. And that's the fundamental point that someone like Prime Minister Harper seems to be missing.
Okay. Well, I think another very important thing that needs to be raised, because you just brought up Saudi Arabia, and they're one of the biggest, or one of our big, Canada's biggest customers for arms is Saudi Arabia. So I wonder what you make of that reality, especially given that this is a country, Canada, the Canadian Prime Minister has been so robust in their opposition to terrorism. And, well, you know, Saudi Arabia is a major sponsor of terrorism. So,
well, yes, you just have to see also the treatment of, for example, the Shia minority in Yemen and the Saudi approach to not just supply the government response, but also to be involved in Saudi jets. And, well, jets supplied by countries like Canada have been involved with strafing positions connected with the Shia minority. There's been a blockade. It's been a vicious battle, in fact, that's, I think, severely underreported. So the broader sense of that is Saudi has this strange relationship with Western countries. And that is largely, to a large extent, it's got to do also with its significance. Of course, again, there is a natural resource issue. It is a, you know, it is a commodities issue. It's oil, and they're still fundamentally very powerful. So there is that lingering issue. But the second thing, too, is that Saudi Arabia has been perceived as some kind of strategic balancer in the region. And so, obviously, there is this idea that it should keep tabs on things. But, of course, it is a terrible human rights abuser. And it's very peculiar, on the one hand, to hold Iran to account to certain abuses, but then not to hold Saudi Arabia. I also found it very a rich remark made by Prime Minister Harper the other day on the issue of the latest deal with Saudi Arabia in terms of selling more arms. And he would regard that as perfectly consistent to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, but no, we're not going to deal with the Russians on that, because they annexed Crimea and they're sort of backing militants in the Donbass or in Ukraine. So we have this typical Janus-faced approach, of course, to foreign policy, you know, which is fundamental and seems to be the modus operandi of the Harper government. And I dare say he's not the only one. I do wonder whether his replacement or new, should he lose office. I just wonder whether that's going to particularly change, because that will be a strong statement to say, well, you know, let us stop arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Because as you rightly pointed out, Saudi Arabia is a sponsor of various groups undermining and destabilizing regimes. Saudi Arabia is to be found everywhere in Syria.
And not exactly a Jeffersonian democracy.
No, certainly not, and they're not particularly interested in that. And in fact, again, for your listeners, it might be of interest for them if they would like to, from the security of their own computer, if not their workspace, look up the Saudi cables that were released recently by WikiLeaks. And they give also a dramatic picture about Saudi foreign policy, and look at exactly those sorts of things about what an otherwise very opaque, archaic state as well in many ways, how it operates with certain degrees of sophistication in peddling information for Western consumption.
We've been speaking with Binoy Campmark. He was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge, and currently serves as senior lecturer in the School of Global Urban and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. He joined us in CKW's Winnipeg studio. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To share his thoughts about the nuclear deal signed between world powers and Iran back in July, and to put it in a geopolitical context, we're joined by Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. Mahdi Nazemroya is an award-winning author and geopolitical analyst, and the author of The Globalization of NATO by Clarity Press. He's a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization and a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. He spoke to us in late September. I was wondering if you could maybe give us help put that whole Iran nuclear deal in its proper context. What are some of the factors here that we really need to take into consideration when we assess, you know, whether or not this is a good deal, all things considered?
All right. Well, it is important to note that the sanctions regime that the United States was enforcing with the European Union was more or less going to collapse, because the Russians and the Chinese made it clear that if there wasn't a deal, they were going to go ahead with trade with the Europeans, start trade. And if this happened, I think other parties, such as the European Union, other countries in Asia, more or less would have been forced to also start trading with the Iranians to maintain their competitiveness, or for economic and geopolitical reasons, they would have in one way or another been forced to start trade with Iran. You have to also remember that this is a time when the United States and the European Union are clamping up sanctions on the Russian Federation. And that means to target Russia, the U.S. and its European Union allies are cutting trade and trade with the Russians. That means energy exports. And the European Union's primary source of energy is the Russian Federation next door. So if they're going to cut off energy supplies, hydrocarbons coming from Russia, natural gas, oil, they need to replace that energy source. And there's no other better source of energy for the European Union than Iran. Iran, before the sanctions, was one of the European Union's biggest energy trading partners, one of the main sources of energy. And because of the sanctions regime of the nuclear energy program that Tehran was running, the European Union cut those energy ties with Iran. But now that it's cutting ties with the Russians, it needs to replace the Russians. And it's the Iranians they need to replace the Russians with. So one way or another, they were going to have to trade with the Iranians. So the points are that the sanctions regime was not going to be maintained because the Russians and the Chinese made it very clear they're going to trade with the Iranians. Once they did, others would have followed along. And if the sanctions regime that the United States has engineered and constructed, if that sanctions structure fell apart, it would have devastating psychological effects on American power, because it would show the United States as a superpower, as one of the world's great powers, not able to enforce sanctions, and this would psychologically have an effect, and this is very bad for an empire. So the U.S. knew that it was forced to negotiate with the Iranians. They knew that it had to stop the sanctions, and then there's the fact that the sanctions against Russia cannot be increased while there's sanctions on Iran. The European Union needs some type of energy source. And the third factor is the economic momentum, the economic freezing, the economic slowdown in the United States and the European Union. So there's an economic decline in the European Union and the United States. And they view the Iranian markets as a way of helping at least mitigate this economic decline. So Iran is a very large country, 70 million people plus, also large population of foreigners are there. It has an educated population. It has an industrial base. It has markets, very large market for airplanes, for example, possibly automobiles, many products. So they also saw this as an opening in a way to help the economies of the European Union and the United States.
Well, what about while we're on the topic of the sanctions? I mean, what about the Iranian economy? I mean, it was still being hurt by these sanctions, was it not?
The sanctions were definitely had an impact on the Iranian economy, but I also think that some things that are blamed on sanctions in the Iranian economy, I would argue, have to do with neoliberalism in Iran. Now, Iran is there's a neoliberal the neoliberal paradigm is something that's been adopted by Iran,
And I think some of the economic changes and even the economic complaints by Iranians, not just a result of sanctions, I think it's a result of neoliberal restructuring in Iran, economic restructuring. For example, subsidies, the oil in Iran, gasoline was subsidized by the government. Those subsidies have been taken away. Instead, they've given quotas, things like that. Those type of readjustments, the economic restructuring, I think, has also been a factor. Of course, there are going to be opponents of Iran. They will try to use this, what I'm saying, and try to blame everything exclusively on the Iranian government in Iran and say, well, it's neoliberal adjustments and it's blaming everything. That's not that isn't the case. The case is the sanctions had an effect, but at the same time, neoliberal economic restructuring also has an effect too. Iran's privatizing a lot of national structures, okay? Ports, for example, you know, things that have been owned by the government, the state. They're being privatized to domestic capital or domestic investors or foreign investors, you know. These things, this has to be also taken into mind.
In terms of the United States and those larger Western interests, there's been a long-standing desire to control that region of the world, Iran. What exactly has the U.S. and its key partners tried to achieve there? You know, wage a war and institute a regime change directly, fracture it? What were the range of strategies that were being contemplated, say, over the last decade or so?
Well, the United States has used a toolbox of different resources with its allies against Iran. Regime change has always been the ultimate goal, but it has also supported separatist movements, ones that are violent and resort to terrorism. So Iran's a country that Jimmy Carter actually said this. I'll paraphrase what he said. It's an island of stability and it's surrounded by in an area filled with chaos, you might say. I'm paraphrasing Carter. You know, he said that, and after that, the Iran revolution happened. But more or less, Iran is a country that's stable. There isn't violent crime. It's not high there. But the United States has tried to destabilize it. It supported terrorist movements, separatist terrorist movements in the province of Sistan and Baluchistan, which is on the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan. In the West, in Khuzestan, there was, after the Americans and the British invaded Iraq in 2003, illegally invaded Iraq and occupied it. You know, terrorism started there on the border, you know, bombings. There's been support for terrorism, support for separatism. And at the same time, opposition groups, you know, they've tried to weaken Iran's resolve psychologically and also to hurt its nuclear energy program by assassinating nuclear scientists. Information that I might add, that the International Atomic Energy Agency had to have passed on about these scientists to the United States and Israel, that led to their assassination. So the IAEA, you know, can't be trusted by the Iranians, and rightly so, in regards to passing on sensitive information that's endangered the lives of Iranian citizens and scientists. There's also the U.S. is what the State Department calls coercive diplomacy, you know, the threats of war, threats of regime change, actions in the United Nations Security Council, actions in the United Nations in general, to put pressure on Iran. There's the Israeli threats. The threats have been consistent. You know, they've always used threats on Iran. And, of course, anything to push for some type of color revolution in Iran. and anything that's divisional. So dividing the Iranian elite, dividing the Iranian population on political grounds, using existing cleavages in Iran to basically do anything to divide the country with the goal of regime change. And one organization the United States has supported is the MEK or MOK, the Mujahideen Khalq, which is an Iranian opposition group that has been basically based in Iraq. They fought against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war. They were on Saddam Hussein's side. It's tried to use this as a card. So when the United States and Britain invaded Iraq illegally again in 2003, they quickly took over Camp Ashraf, and they basically turned the MEK into clients. And they've used all types of means like this. And then, of course, there's the proxy war against Syria. What's happening in Syria has a lot to do with Iran. It's aimed against Iran, so they've targeted Iran's allies, whether they're in the Palestinian territories or whether it's in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and its allies in the March 8th alliance, which includes the biggest Christian party in Lebanon, Michel Aoun's Free Patriotic Movement, Soleiman Farangi's Al-Marada Party, Nabi Berri's Amal Party or Amal Movement, Harakat Amal. Whether it's targeting these parties or the Syrian government, they've tried to weaken Iran in one means or another, regionally and internally.
At this point, would you be prepared to rule out any kind of an overt war with Iran like what we saw against Iraq in 2003?
The U.S. government has disregarded international law whenever it was in its interests, and it would have done so with Iran if it could have walked, if it was a walk in the park. But an attack on Iran is not a walk in the park. You know, this is a country that can defend itself. It has missile ballistic missiles pointed at American bases in the region. You know, it can sink the American fleet. There was war games that simulated an American invasion of Iran. They saw that the U.S. fleet in the Persian Gulf would be annihilated. You know, the American ships would be sunk. And this is also a country that has allies. It is aligned at a regional level, not only with the Syrian government, but with various groups in Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine. Okay, it has clout internationally, and it also is aligned to the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation, as well as several post-Soviet states. So the ramifications of an attack on Iran could escalate into a World War III scenario. They would go well beyond the borders of the Middle East and Southwest Asia. Europe and Africa would be the fronts in such a war. There would be ramifications there. And with the Russian or Chinese involvement, this is a World War III scenario, not just a regional war.
Hmm. Now, how does this new approach to Iran with the nuclear deal, what you essentially say is a face-saving concession in order to relax the sanctions, how does this impact on Russia? Or how does it strengthen the America and EU's hands against this new enemy that is or new old enemy that is Russia?
Okay, well, I liked how you phrased this new old enemy. Well, this will allow them, as they think or calculate, to clamp up against the Russians. But in order for this to be as successful as they want, they need to co-opt the Iranians or to have an understanding with the Iranians to at least be neutral to some ends against the Russians. And I don't think that's going to happen. The Iranians and the Russians are allies. They're strategic allies. whether some people in Moscow or Tehran don't like it, that's the reality. That's the nature of the relationship. We can see them coordinating in Syria and the broader Middle East together. We can see them coordinating on global issues together. We can see they have their policies on Latin America. Although they are independent of one another, there is coordination by both sides. They coordinate in regards to terrorist threats. They have an understanding. They both have there's the Russian Security Council and the Iranian Security Council have coordination and contacts. Their military cooperation has been increasingly The Iranian defense ministers has made some high level visits to Moscow and vice versa. The Russian defense minister, general of the army, Sergei Shoigu, has been in Tehran. The contacts between them are increasingly becoming strategic and more important, although there are differences to some level. They coordinate when in regards to the Middle East, the Caucasus, specifically the South Caucasus, the Caspian Sea Basin, and Central Asia and Afghanistan. They coordinate in these areas where their interests overlap and to some degree are interlocked, including as well as the Eastern Mediterranean. They're both propping up the Syrian government and in many regards coordinating regards to global affairs. Okay, and they're also supportive of Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua. These countries, they both have good ties with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea or North Korea, and they're supportive of that against U.S. pressure, along with the Chinese. You know, the Chinese are part of this. China, Russia, and Iran make a Eurasian entente or a Eurasian triple entente. So there is a strategic alliance where there's an access between Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing. And the U.S. wants to spoil this. It basically wants to turn the Iranians against the Russians and to spoil any strategic alignment between them. And that's because the U.S. is targeting Russia now and trying to play the Iranians against the Russians, but that will not be successful at all.
I imagine another complicating factor is the United States' very close relationship with Israel, and Israel, at least outwardly, has nothing nice to say about Iran. It seems to me if you crush Iran, that's not going to be enough. So given that strategic partnership between the U.S. and Israel, one wonders if Iran owes the United States any favors, nuclear deal or no.
I don't think the United States is owed any favors by the Iranians. Tehran doesn't owe it any favors. I think any agreements they make are done in for mutual benefit, and on the U.S. side, definitely out of necessity. I would add that it's not only Israel; it's Saudi Arabia that falls into this boat, where it's not happy with the deal with Iran. But I want to point out that a lot of things you hear from the administration in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a lot of it is also for domestic consumption and also for to ensure that Israel's military is still being subsidized by the United States. I mean, in all honesty, to a degree, there is even Israeli products that are sold in Iran, you know. Anti-war activists from North America were surprised when they went to Tehran, I think last year or the year before, when they found out that some Iranians were complaining that we are bringing products from Israel into the country. You know, there's a lot more to the picture that's unnoticed or goes unnoticed. I think a lot of the things that the Israelis say is is rhetorical, especially in regards to the Netanyahu's government, including threats against Iran. Israel has no capabilities to launch a massive war against the Iranians. I mean, it does threaten war. It does have nuclear assets. It does want to maintain some sort of policy of, let's say, mutual assured destruction against Iran, Matt, by stationing Dolphin nuclear strike submarines in the Persian Gulf that could target Iran. But at the end of the day, it can't really execute a war against Iran as much as it postures. So they're two totally different levels. I don't think the Israelis militarily can defeat the Iranians.
Okay. So is there any risk? Is there a realistic risk that a future president may just, like, as we're hearing all of these congressional or Senate Republicans trying to sabotage this nuclear deal? I don't know. Are those feelings genuine? And if so, do you anticipate that a future president, say a Republican president, one of like Donald Trump, say, or whoever the next president should happen to be, that they could potentially change the, you know, go back on this and return to the previous what you consider to be a very failed sanctions regime? That's are we seeing more of that same kind of rhetorical flourish?
Well, I think that there's rhetoric involved, definitely, but there's also tactical factors behind what's happening in the United States, aside from domestic politics. I think that we should note, I'd like audiences to note that whenever the U.S. Congress gets involved here, there are also considerations for getting further concessions from Iran, whether it's public or not. So the threats of not passing any nuclear, supporting any nuclear agreement, you know, they do get the U.S. concessions. When Israel threatens Iran, in many aspects, it coordinates with the U.S. government, and it gives the U.S. leverage. So this gives U.S. leverage in other terms. There's other negotiations going on. There's talks about other things going on. You know, these nuclear negotiations, the prelude to them was when the United States wanted to attack Syria a few years ago, you know, after the chemical weapons incident. Okay, the U.S. wanted to attack Syria. It postured like it was going to attack Syria, but in reality, if it did, this would have resulted in a broader war. But I think they did that to gain traction in negotiations with Iran, which had started through the Sultanate of Oman secretly, okay, which shocked American allies, and even because it was secretly done. The Saudis were not happy about that. It was secretly done. So the Iranians and the U.S. have been talking through back channels, and I think this gives it gives the U.S. room to maneuver to get concessions from Iran. And I want to point out that the U.S. has gotten concessions from Iran as well. This nuclear agreement that has been made by the P5 plus one, the permanent 5 plus one, which is Germany, meaning the permanent 5 Security Council members in Germany, or the EU plus EU 3 plus 3, okay, this agreement that's been made by them, more or less legitimizes illegal behavior. Okay, and what I mean by that is the nuclear, under the non-proliferation treaty, nuclear non-proliferation treaty, the NPT, Iran has an absolute right to enrich uranium. Okay, all countries have a right to enrich uranium for peaceful means. This nuclear agreement basically justifies Iran's rights being reduced. So concessions have been made to the United States. There's limits on the Iranian nuclear program that are unlawful, but Iran's agreed to go along with them to drop the sanctions. So concessions have been made. And what's happening in Congress and also in regards to U.S. domestic presidential politics, I want this to be noted very heavily. U.S. foreign policy is a continuum. it's a continuation. It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or Republicans in power. It goes in a continuum. It's a structure that's very hard to change. Obama's government, the Obama administration, is a national unity administration. What I mean by national unity is that it was a coalition administration, which includes Democrats and Republicans. Let's not forget Robert Gates, his defense minister, was a Republican. Other members of the staff and the administration were Republicans. Okay, Hillary Clinton was his Democratic opponent. She was brought in as the Secretary of State. After then, of course, she's been replaced now by John Kerry. But this is a government that has worked in consensus. It's a consensus of the American political establishment. So it's going to go on in a continuum. And I actually said this in an interview days before Donald Trump said, well, he said that he would maintain the nuclear agreement, but he would still press on the Iranians. So this agreement's going to be continued. The only time it won't be continued by the administration is if the U.S. Wants to backstab the Iranians, but it's not going to be because of a change in politics. It's going to be because of an intentionally calculated move by the United States. And at the same time that the United States is talking to the Iranians, let's not forget what's happening in the Middle East and neighboring Iraq and Syria. You know, the so-called Islamic State, or as they say, as they call it by the Arabic acronym Daesh, or as we say in the English acronyms, ISIL or ISIS. This group has been nurtured to destabilize the region, to destabilize even Iran, because it's next door to Iran. Just like how Ukraine is being used to destabilize Russia and some other post-Soviet republics like Belarus, the situation in the Middle East next door to Iran is also being used to create instability there and to justify the marshalling of massive U.S. military assets, as well as a coalition of countries into that part of the world. You know, they're bombing Syria already, so regime change in Syria is not off the map, and they could eventually be used to target Iran. So, I mean, at the same time that this nuclear agreement's been made, this is what's happening. So Iran's very much still in the crosshairs.
Thanks for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I look forward to talking to you once I'm back from Asia.
That was award-winning author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazemroya speaking to us in late September. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.